It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. We've got a really big show. What happened to Flappy Bird? We've got a new CEO at Microsoft. Coincidence? I think not. And a goodbye to the Jade Rabbit. It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 444, recorded February 9th, 2014. Well played, Mr. Dong. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 28 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code TWIT214. And by Carbonite. Whether you have one computer at home or several at your small business, Carbonite backs up your files to the cloud automatically and continually. Plus, access your files anytime, anywhere with a free app. Start your free trial at Carbonite.com. No credit card required. Use the offer code TWIT and you'll get 2 bonus months with purchase. And by GoToMeeting with HD Faces from Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients anywhere. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. Even present from an iPad. Start your 30-day free trial of GoToMeeting today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code TWIT. And by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. To get this special offer, go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone, and enter TWIT. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech, the show that covers your technology news for the week, and we got a great panel joining us from IDG editorial director Jason Snell, editor-in-chief at Macworld Magazine. Good to see you, Jason.
Great to be back.
It's rainy around here. You forded the rivers.
We Californians do not take to rain or other things coming from the sky. It's confusing.
It's so
people
rainy.
Don't know how to drive in it and all that, but it's nice. We haven't had any rain in like a year, yeah. So it's good to get some.
We've been drying out. Also joining us, Mr. Brian Brushwood from Austin, Texas, host of NSFW, Scam School, and Hacking the System.
Yeah, man, I'm on TV. Look, Mom, I made it.
Congratulations, new National Geographic show, which it turns out Brian's been filming for the last 4 years without telling us. Now, when did you start filming it?
We started shooting over the summer, but of course, you know, television, everything moves so slow. So it's like we had the idea over a year ago, started pitching it. And man, the hardest thing about everything is keeping your stupid mouth shut about everything.
I couldn't do it.
It's something, you know, I'm so excited about it. And so it was great to be able to finally announce it on NSFW this last week.
Yay. It's on National Geographic. It was on last Thursday. What day is...
No. It's the 2 episodes. It'll be an hour-long special, February 27th on Nat Geo. Check your local
listing. I thought they said this Thursday.
No, it will be a Thursday. two weeks from now.
Okay. It's called Hacking the System. And it's only 2 episodes?
Yeah. Well, they're running it as a special. So it's like, you know, I'm just glad that the thing's actually on TV. I mean, you know how this business goes. You have so many projects that fizzle and don't become what you want. Like, this is a show I love. I'm happy with how it turned out. It was a lot of fun to shoot. We got to blow up cars and shoot machine guns and
you're gonna
break into houses and
hack
stuff.
The car awesome. That's exciting. Well, good. Can't wait. Thank you. Thank you for being here, Brian. And we've got a newbie on here. I want to welcome Jessica Lesson. We talked to Jess. Actually, Jessica was on the phone with us before.
For a while, yeah.
Yeah, you were in that.
Better to be real.
But I'm so glad you're here in the studio
you.
With us. Jessica is editor-in-chief of The Information, which is a very new tech news site you created behind a paywall, should mention. But I subscribed immediately. Really valuable, Jessica, for many years at the Wall Street Journal, where we quoted you all the time. Actually, we still quote you. You got a great scoop this week. Susan Wojcicki moving from ads to YouTube.
Yep. She's taken over the helm from Salar. And it's an interesting move because Susan, you know, Susan is the one who Google was built in her garage. I mean, she was the first.
Her mom leased the garage to the boys.
Yes.
And then Larry married her sister.
Sergey.
Sergey married her sister. And then now Susan, has she been working at Google since that time?
She has. She's was running all of ad products. So AdSense, AdWords, commerce, et cetera.
There's not much more important at Google than that.
It's very important. It kind of is a well-oiled machine at this point, though. So I think this is a new challenge and hopefully bringing that kind of operational experience to YouTube, which has some revenue problems.
They are getting less and less money per ad, right?
Their revenue's growing, usage is growing, but they can't get the ad prices up. And if they don't get, if they can't charge more and make individual ads more valuable, it's going to be tough to get to the next level and to get to more professional content like TV shows, sports, all that kind of stuff.
Part of the battle over YouTube is what should YouTube be? I mean, it really was a place for viral videos for a long time. And I can see YouTube kind of trying to, it feels like fit a square peg into a round hole saying, no, this is where the networks are going to put their content. And it doesn't really, those two are not compatible, really.
They haven't been. And I think the reason it's so complicated is we don't know where this whole market is going. So, you know, there's
it's
so
not just
many
YouTube,
players.
Is it?
And so I think everyone kind of wants a piece of it. They want to be able to grab more and more content. But, you know, YouTube is still in that base of viral clips, promotional things. Some shows now, you know, their channels initiative where, but
wasn't that kind of a flop though?
You know, it depends who you ask. I think that there are definitely a lot of channels who said they could not build big businesses just off of it. So they are continuing to invest in it, but there are a lot of questions, but you can't ignore them because they've, you know, they've got the traffic, they have the assets in that regard. And
well, she, you know, it's been, go ahead, Brian.
Oh, I was going to say, what's been fascinating to me is to see an almost Wikipedia type of aspect to the whole YouTube phenomenon. Because you're right. It used to be YouTube was where you saw cats on surfboards and people getting kicked in the nuts. But
still do.
Well, sure. That's still there. But what's amazing is to think about how many instructional things you go to find YouTube on. Like YouTube is a library. It's where we go to learn how to perform CPR, to change a carburetor, to learn a magic trick. I mean, it's like this instructional. Think about all of Khan Academy is based on what's great about YouTube and the ability for you to tune in and learn, you know, how insulin inhibits, you know, blood sugar or whatever in a tight little 5-minute lecture on there. I would like to think that that's what YouTube's legacy is really going to be, but I don't know.
I don't know. I'm looking popular on YouTube worldwide. Pet squirrel hides his nut in the fur of a Bernese dog. Can music improve athletic performance? Jay Leno's Heartfelt Goodbye, that's NBC, that's official. An honest Facebook movie. See, now I want to watch that. And then I got to watch an ad, which I don't want to watch, so I close
it. Tell you,
and
know,
there you go. That's Google. That's YouTube there, in a nutshell. I should have watched the squirrel.
The YouTube ad thing, that whole ability to skip ads and for them to now change ads to try to engage you in those first 4 seconds to get you just long enough to hang around and maybe watch the rest, because I don't know exactly how those rules work behind the scene, but essentially they only get paid if they watch the whole thing. However, they're getting paid for a targeted viewer who's obviously engaged enough to sit and on purpose choose to watch an ad, which you would think would be much more valuable than some, you know, just throwing it at the wall during a Super Bowl and hoping something sticks.
And they have. I mean, they've been innovating with a lot of formats. So now we see the sort of small banner that pops up in the bottom of videos everywhere. And YouTube was the first to try that. But the bigger question is just, you know, can you get the kind of content like sports that have significantly higher CPMs, you know, full episodes of television shows? They're doing some of it. I mean, I watched the first episode of Girls this season on HBO, a promotional thing I saw through
YouTube.
You
went on YouTube.
So it's so fascinating.
But it will be over HBO's dead body that they put the whole season
on. It's promotional.
YouTube.
It's teasing. Yeah. It's marketing. But you wouldn't have seen that a few years ago. So I think it's definitely a place to watch. But
well, I think we all watch YouTube a lot. I just think it's hard to... I think it's got to be hard to monetize because you just don't know what the environment's going to be. Mm-hmm. You don't know if you're going to be on a squirrel video or a Leno goodbye video.
Well, and there's clips. YouTube's really good for clips, for short clips. And there's that question. I mean, sometimes I go to YouTube to watch a movie trailer and there's an ad before it. And I'm like, wait a second, I'm watching an ad. See an ad
for an ad.
That's,
I see that.
That's
I hate
a little
that.
Bit strange.
Yeah.
My kids use it for music. It's like the place you go if you want to listen to a song. The songs, and they're not even watching the video, even if there is video, because what YouTube has done really well is it's easy to upload things, it's easy to find them, and it's easy to jump to a particular moment in a clip, too, which, you know, a lot of multimedia stuff on the web is really hard to, like podcasts. You kind of can't discover podcasts, but YouTube videos are really easy to discover.
You can actually put a key in the link that goes right to it,
jumps
that
spot to a certain number of seconds.
I don't
seconds
know how many people know that, but that's it's in the share button.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did, to Brian's point, I changed the, I got a replacement for my car stereo, and it came with the typical, like, impossible to decipher instruction manual about how to install it myself. And I searched on YouTube, and there was a dude out in the snow in Minnesota putting it in his car and freezing while he was doing it. And I followed the YouTube video. I got my laptop, put it in the car, and that's how I learned how to do it.
But I think
the paper,
that's Google's problem, because I bet you the search you did was a Google search, not a YouTube search.
Right, but of course,
and you found a list of instructions, and it's some blog, and what's embedded on the blog but the YouTube video. He's getting free bandwidth for his video. And I guess they could show an ad there, but that's kind of the problem, isn't it?
It's right, a hard ad to target, too. So in some ways, it isn't. I mean, if that part, if there's a manufacturer for the part you're looking in, that could be a very highly valuable ad.
But and does YouTube sell those ads that way? Can they say?
They can get pretty granular. I mean, They can get into the type of content, type of audience. I mean, that's the Google sort of engineering brains, right? So they're good at that.
And
I
that's think what Susan Wojcicki well, is very good at. That's what
absolutely
she's been doing.
And doing that at scale and then getting all the partners to agree to that, to show that it's actually moving the needle for them. So,
well, and that's the biggest problem is a lot of the advertisers, they want to buy the certain personality. They're like, we want to buy ads just on Jenna Randall Johnson's show or whatever. Yeah. And Google does not want that, because that leaves their entire long tail unmonetized. They're like, well, you say you want Ray William Johnson or whatever, but what you really mean is males 18 to 24 making this kind of stuff. And then we'll do that and it'll include this buy over here. And that's what advertisers are not responding to. Now, meanwhile, it does seem like a noble goal for them to try to get to happen, because you just want it to hit that targeted audience. But it seems like the people holding the purse strings are not a big fan of this idea that they can't buy individual personalities or shows.
Now, J.C. Calhoun in our chat room says, I'm talking from the advertiser's perspective, and I am. I mean, because there seems to be a disconnect between what we as users want from YouTube and what advertisers want from YouTube, and it doesn't seem like the users are particularly interested in making a platform that Google can monetize, and that's the challenge.
YouTube, the community of YouTube users is very easy to piss off, and Google's done it many times before, and they don't want to do it again. Right. And I think to another point that was brought up, I mean, even though it's unbelievable to us given how mature the web is, but video buyers are still largely TV buyers within agencies, and they're still thinking of buying along those along personalities and along shows and with the same kind of metrics as TV. And that's the challenge for YouTube and everyone else, for Facebook, for Hulu, to prove, no, guys, think about it our way, not your way.
Isn't it amazing?
Well, and isn't that the weird part? Like inherently, you would think that online advertising, for whether it's Hulu or YouTube or whatever, you're able to do things that you could never do with traditional television ads.
That's
you can,
the value.
Number one, make sure it actually gets seen. You can know specifically who saw it and in what condition and whether they skip stuff ahead. You would think that all that would make online ads a premium that you would pay more than traditional advertising. But instead, we see the opposite. We see these bargain basement prices.
Meanwhile, here's a video on YouTube. NBC aired this video. All visitors to Sochi Olympics immediately hacked. By the way, this will guarantee that the show gets pulled from YouTube right away. So just want to watch this.
As tourists and we'll just talk constantly.
Let's make noise.
There you go.
Tell us more,
let's
Brian
offer
Williams.
Witty insights and parodies.
NBC's international correspondent Richard Engel, working with a security expert from Trend Micro. Basically, go ahead and play the audio.
And as Richard Engel found out upon his arrival there, it's not a matter of if, but when. Richard, good evening.
So first of all, this whole thing was shot in Moscow, not Sochi.
Good evening,
just
Brian.
So you know.
It is not just hacking. The State Department warns that travelers should have no expectation of privacy, even in their hotel rooms.
Well, we know that because the guy in charge of Sochi said, no, they are hacking hotel rooms. We have cameras, and we see them turn on shower in morning and leave on all day, which really kind of made me nervous, but that's another story.
Especially exposed as soon as you try and communicate with anything.
One of the first things visitors to Russia will do is log on. Hackers here
log on to, wait a minute. Log on to what? Okay, go ahead.
So we decided to find out how dangerous that can be.
Kyle.
Hey.
Welcome to Moscow.
Yeah, thank you.
With the help of Kyle Wilhoit, a top American computer security expert.
So they had three computers, each of which they pulled out of the box. Without updates, they put them online. And then they went to websites, the same exact websites you could go to from right
and
here.
Two brand new computers.
Has nothing to do with Moscow. We know this because
with these fresh machines.
The guy from Trend Micro blogged the details. Nice job opening the Apple box. Ever opened one of those before, Richard? It's not
mutilated.
It's like they purposely designed those boxes to be a joy to open.
He tore it open.
It's like he's got meat hooks for hands and just like,
he thought it was a FedEx box.
Inside.
So.
From the producers of To Catch a Predator, it's to open an Apple box.
Yeah. To open an Apple box.
The only real detail, my name.
So you're putting my profile on these computers.
That's exactly right.
With our new computers now loaded with potentially attractive data, we headed for a restaurant where we used a new smartphone to browse for information.
So-called smartphone.
So apparently what he did is he goes, they don't show this, they did it out. He goes into the Android phone, turns off, checks the box that says allow third-party downloads. And, of course, you immediately get the warning. That's a very dangerous thing to do. Are you sure you want to do it? Yes, okay. Yes. And then intentionally goes and downloads malware. Knowingly.
Wow.
Okay, but watch what happens next.
We were hacked.
We were hacked!
Yeah, I did. Right. It's actually downloading a piece of malware.
Because you asked it to!
Before we even finished our coffee.
Coffee was also hacked. More on that later. Hackers
the option so to how did this blow up in their faces? How did it become
the guy from Trend Micro set this up, blogged about it. Said, I just want to be clear what actually
happened.
Common sense.
Common sense.
Yeah, and he said later, you know, everything we did is exactly what you should not do. And it didn't matter that they were a coffee shop in Moscow. If you do it sitting right here at this table, it's the same websites. They went to malicious websites and ran programs when the websites asked them to. All the things you're not supposed to do. But they edited it out. What did they make you? I can continue to play it. They make it look like there was no interaction at all. They edit out the part where he downloads and says yes and runs the program.
Kaspersky Labs, one of the largest computer security companies in the world, is charged with protecting the games. But
so when he made this blog post explaining all this, this was him trying to clear the air so that he didn't feel dinged on this, right?
I kind of feel like he realized that in editing, it kind of looked a little different than it actually was. The blog post is behind the scenes, behind the NBC honeypots. It's on the Trend Micro blog. And he says, first, these attacks required some kind of user interaction, whether to execute the applications or open a Word document. All the attacks shown required user interaction, which was edited out. Second, these attacks could happen anywhere. Third, the infections incurred on newly unboxed hardware had basic security precautions such as updating the operating system been taken, none of these would have happened. In fact, I think they installed Java on the Macintosh because it said all the three computers had Flash and Java installed. And that means
Mac doesn't ship with Flash or Java.
Or Java. That means they actively installed malware vectors on the Mac. Mm-hmm. It's a completely typical bogus story from NBC, and no one's called them on it except for this blog post.
I think there were some other blog posts that maybe provoked that one, too. So I think the
people were upset.
Security researchers are
bogus.
On it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Just thought I'd give them a little plug.
You got to wonder what the thought process is. NBC's got the Olympics. There are so many controversies about the Olympics anyway that there's no end to what they can cover controversial about it if they want to. And instead they do this weird simplified story about computer hacking in Russia.
If I were John C. Dvorak and this were the No Agenda show, I would say there was an agenda in Russia to make the Russians look horrible. The Sochi Problems Twitter account, the pictures, many of which it turns out have been faked or misinterpreted about problems in the hotels and so forth. It almost feels like there's a concerted campaign. Is it just me that feels that?
I think it's people jealous that they're not at the Olympics. This is what I think it is. I think that
it's FOMO.
You're having fun if you're over there, and if you're not, you're like, Sochi problems. Wouldn't want to be there.
But, you know, we see this kind of thing whenever there's a mold that we feel like stuff should fit in, and there's any kind of evidence that seems to exactly fit in what we expect. You know, we all have preconceived notions that everything's corrupt. We've heard that there's going to be the most corrupt Olympics ever, and, you know, worried about terrorism threats, and Putin's putting on a dog and pony show to cover up XYZ. Like, we hear all that, and then as a result, when we get, you know, a photo, whether it's doctored or not, you know, it's hard to not instantly want to jump on it and pass it around. So I don't know that it's a concerted campaign. I think that there's just preconceived notions that we're hearing that when we see something that matches it, we don't, it short circuits our critical thinking skills. And instead we just immediately forward it. Because to be honest, like this, you know, like this news story exactly fits what I imagine Russia right. is. Russia's right. nothing but drunk people pirating at all times right. and hacking at all right. times.
You can't go across the border into Russia without getting hacked was the message of that piece, and it was completely BS. And, you know, I understand mainstream news does this because it's link bait, their version of link bait.
The original story was really fair, and then it was hacked. See, that's what they don't want you to know.
That's it. I don't understand why there would be this concerted anti-Russian campaign, but there seems to be. Not that Putin isn't encouraging it by riding around topless on a horse, but not that I would do anything like that. We're going to take a break and come back in just a moment. Our show today brought to you by the way, great panel, Shutterstock.com. Great panel. We got Jason Snell from IDG, Jessica Lessard from The Information, which everyone must subscribe to. I do. Love it. Just added a managing editor. A new programmer. He's going to write software for you?
He's working on some new features already.
Isn't it interesting? We're in the same boat where we're really a media startup, but in this day and age, you're a technology startup whether you like it or not.
Absolutely.
Because you have to solve all these issues, these technology issues, before you can get to your viewers or readers. Brian Brushwood, host of a brand new show on National Geographic, debuting February 27th, Hacking the System.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stealing your stuff and blowing up your cars.
Yeah.
And cheating your salesman.
Really?
Yeah, that's what we did. We did a segment talking about psychological hacks that used car salesmen use.
It's only fair because they always do that. Oh, well, I got to go talk to the manager about this. I don't know if we can give you this deal.
That's exactly. We talk about the appeal to authority, and we talk about how you can use the exact same trick on them by saying, like, well, it's not really up to me. It's up to the wife. And so you just call and then, you know.
I'm sorry. I can't give you a decision today. I have to talk to the manager, my wife.
Exactly.
Yeah. Our show brought to you by Shutterstock.com. They have the perfect image or video for your next creative project. So many blogs. We use Shutterstock. So many blogs use Shutterstock because it always turns out when you post something on a blog, an image makes such a difference in a blog post, whether it's for your website or it's a publication. Maybe you're doing advertising, a video. 28 million. Actually, there's probably more. I like to visit Shutterstock because the number goes up all the time. Last count, 28 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips. No, it's more. It's more. It's now 33,503,207, ladies and gentlemen. 273,000 new images this week. Don't forget when you go to Shutterstock.com to try, and you don't have to be a member, although I'll tell you why you might want to make an account. It's free to do so. But try the search engine because it's not just now. You know, normally with a site like this, you'd be searching for, I don't know, Olympic rings. But you can also search for happy Olympic rings or green Olympic rings. The search engine is incredible.
I'm typing in here just to see if it works. I'm writing Olympic rings on fire.
I bet you could.
Let's see what I get.
Let me see.
Dude, look at that. Well, look at that. Boom. It's you got fire and you got
look at that.
You got Olympic rings on fire. Of course, the Olympic torch.
So here's the deal. If you create an account, and it's free to do so, you don't have to give them any credit card or anything. You can then save these into the Lightbox. You can share them with other people. You can use them as inspiration. I have to say, sometimes just having an image gives me an inspiration for a blog post or an idea for a story. Just the image kind of gets you thinking along the lines you'd like to be. So do create that free account. If you decide you want to buy, there are all sorts of ways to do it. There's image packages. We have the 25 image a day subscription. That's a great one. You can download any image in any size. Pay only one price. They're royalty free, so you can use them in a variety of ways. Multilingual customer support. They're in more than a dozen countries. and, of course, full-time customer support throughout the week. Try Shutterstock today. You don't need a credit card to start the account, but once you decide to buy, do use our offer code TWIT214. TWIT214. You get 25% off any package. That's a really good deal on the subscriptions. Shutterstock.com for 25% off new accounts. TWIT214. Of course, it's February 2014. That's where that comes from. So you can remember it easily. Shutterstock.com. Flappy Bird.
Flappy Bird. Moment Flappy of silence. Bird. Moment of silence
a moment
Flappy
of silence Bird. For Flappy Bird. It is no more.
I'll tell you what, man. I felt kind of bad. Like, I was late to the Flappy Bird
No, no,
train.
No, you weren't. No one was late. It started a week ago. You can't be late.
Well, I finally signed up. I played exactly 3 games, and I said, screw this, and then uninstalled it, and I was going to make a lot of hay crapping on the game. But then, like, all of a sudden...
Now you feel bad.
Yeah, all at once, like, now apparently you got to remember, there's a real developer who really wasn't trying to break your mind with amazing art. He just wanted to make a dumb game with a flapping bird.
And his name
now
is...
Now the whole world's...
His real name is Dong, by the way. I don't know if you know that. Dong Nguyen. He is a Vietnamese developer. Yeah. Independent. Now, here's the interesting story. There is more to this Flappy Bird story. I want the information to dig deep into this.
Okay. What questions do you have?
So here's the deal. I didn't know this. The game came out in May.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nothing for 6 months. Nothing.
There's too many other games. I mean, you got to be like the game of the moment, right? I mean, you've got Candy Crush.
So how do you get discovered if you are a game that looks like Mario Brothers, has literally no gameplay, all you do is flap, and if you're lucky, get through these things, which apparently some people can to the degree of hundreds. I'm lucky to get through one.
Cheeto in the chat showed me a screenshot of him having a score of 111, which I can't even wrap my mind around.
I've got two. My best is 5.
My best is 5, yeah.
So nobody knows of that anything about this game, except... And this is kind of interesting. All of a sudden, and somebody did the plot of this. What was the link for that, Chad? I'm going to see if I can find that. Somebody started plotting reviews in the App Store. All of a sudden, they started to come in hot about December. And the presumption is that Mr. Flappy Bird, Dong Nguyen, was buying reviews to jumpstart this. And in fact, more than that, because he has several games, and they all started getting more reviews at the same time. They all started to spike up. Let's see. This is Zach Will's blog. He did a you know, kind of like a scrape of all the reviews. We've all read The Verge's story that Dong is making $50,000 a day on the ads. But here's the spike. This is what's very interesting. Nothing. No reviews. Sometime in late December, early January, he says, I'm guessing Dong Nguyen probably used some sort of service to download rate Flappy Bird on the App Store to generate buzz. It worked. Flappy Bird starting getting 20 reviews a day. Then on January 9th, 90 reviews. On the 12th, it doubled. At 17th, it doubled again. Suddenly it starts to take off. And I presume at this point it goes viral and it's real reviews. But if you read the reviews, and he does put some of them on here, you could see that there's a certain amount of similarity, the early reviews. They all have this kind of morbid, I'm going to kill myself. This game is killing me. I want to kill this guy. The apocalypse, the death of me. My life is over. Don't do it. Don't you do it. My life is expiring, running out of control. I'm going to kill myself. These are all the first reviews coming in. They all sound fake. It's really interesting to watch this. So it does take off. It does go viral. And I know it went viral. It went viral around here. One person downloaded it, and all of a sudden everybody's playing it. I don't understand why. I was talking to one of our interns here, Eli, who goes to a local high school. How long did it take before everybody was playing it, Eli?
3 days.
Every student playing it. I don't know why. There's something compelling about it. Then yesterday, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say,
first Mr. Hacker, you know why.
Yeah, I mean, that's a testament to this is what Robert Cialdini calls a fixed action pattern, where it's like we can't help
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You're not making this up, because the abbreviation fixed action pattern is FAP. You're not making
No, that's That's why when I do my talk about social engineering, I make sure to abbreviate it as FAP.
Okay. All right.
But yes, no, that is what it's called. it's a mental shortcut that like, for example, one of the classic ones was Harvard did a study to see if you could cut in front of lines. And so they found a bunch of people waiting for a Xerox machine. They had somebody go and ask different variations of the question, can I cut in line to do my stuff faster? And they figured out that the magic word was because. As long as you use the word because, it's like they shortcutted their brain. And they're like, well, she's got some reason, so fine, go. And even if it was a nonsense way to phrase it, like, hey, can I jump in front of line because I need to make some copies and I'm in a rush? Like, that's not an excuse. That's not a reason. They're like, oh, you said the word because. Go ahead.
Wow.
So likewise, that's that social proof is the reason that Yelp, of course, is so popular. And to be honest, it's the reason that our joke experiment, the Diamond Club book, was such a success, is because so many people bought it all at once. And they all left fake reviews saying it was the best thing since 50 Shades of Grey. And of course, it was, you know, a hilarious fake erotic fiction book.
You're the king of gaming the system. You know how to sell this stuff works.
Well, yeah, and there's some part of me that you know, obviously we all sneer and turn our nose up at the idea of buying reviews, but I mean, how far off is it from me releasing a project and saying, let's all buy it at the same time and everybody like, comment, and subscribe at the same time and gaming the system? You know, like, I guess the only benefit to when we do it with NSFW is that we're transparent about it and we make it clear that this is a game that we're playing, whereas it does feel smarmy and underhanded if it's a paid for service.
And Apple's been really trying to crack down on that. And I don't know some secret system of how they do it, but I mean, it bots that download apps and they're pretty much, you know, are policing those
as they
left
should.
And right. And so, and I am sure that they have checks looking for spikes in reviews and suspicious reviews and are also monitor that closely. So if they did go ahead and do that, which seems, I guess, very plausible, they would have had a lot of systems to circumvent. And I bet a lot of things get caught and maybe this one didn't.
What's weird is nobody denies the fact that it became viral. I mean, legitimately viral, right? I mean, it did take off.
One of the things that the App Store charts are based on is velocity of downloads.
Right.
And so you don't, it's not even how many you have, it's right. How fast.
So the hockey stick, it was number one in 12 countries. Guy's making a ton of money. Then yesterday he tweets, I'm sorry, Flappy Bird users. 22 hours from now, I will take Flappy Bird down. I cannot take this anymore. And then he says, it's not related to legal issues. I just cannot keep it anymore. Then he says, I don't sell Flappy Bird. Don't ask, and I still make games, and that's the last we've heard of him. And
so,
huge response on Twitter, by the way. If you search, his Twitter handle is Dongatory. If you search for Dongatory and FU, unbelievable vitriol on this guy.
I mean, do you think it is the case that that he just couldn't handle it? It's such an intentionally agonizingly difficult game. Like, that's the one redeeming quality about it, is that it's genuinely hard and it's hard for everyone and it is frustrating but weirdly addictive. Do you think he just hated the personal hate that he was getting from everyone?
I'm telling you, I don't want to show this on screen because it's so profane, but if you care to do the search...
Going right now.
Yeah, that's not good. This is it. This is the fire hose of the internet being turned on somebody who didn't really expect it. I think he was hoping he would make some money from his game. And, you know, success breeds success until you're all the way at the top there. But then he got the criticism that, oh, it was like this other game and that he was just a hack who took stuff off a shelf and all that. And he became the focus of something. And I think this guy was not interested. He was very happy playing at the edges of this culture and make a little money on the side on a little game with some ads.
$50,000 a day.
I think something's suspicious. I don't think you just, you don't just say, sorry guys, it's not like this is that hard to maintain. You could keep it up there and keep your mouth shut.
It's Apple's server,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, there's something else going on. You don't just turn down that.
It was on Android and iOS. He removed it from both. I mean, I could see Apple might have said, hey, Dong, you got to do something about this. But I don't know if Google did too, maybe?
I bet there's just something that spooked him, whether it's from the companies or from some sort of threat or something. And so he's withdrawing. But
he got more hate than Woody Allen last week. I mean, this guy, for pulling a game, just horrible Twitter.
No, someone's going to make Flappy Bird 2 or change the name so that it's...
Oh, there's 800 Flappy Bird already. 800 Flappy Bird clones. I mean, you just go there. There's Crappy Bird. There's Farty Bird.
There you go.
You've got one on the Pebble
I've
watch.
I've got the Pebble. It's a Tiny Bird.
It's. Just, I mean, you can't copyright Flappy yeah. Bird. So Robert Scoble's theory. I'm going to say that with a straight face. Robert Scoble's theory is it's great marketing. In 6 months,
he'll come out again
from the creator of Flappy Bird.
Yeah. Pro.
Well, his last tweet is, "I still make games."
Yeah,
this feels like a Justin Bieber retiring.
You think
kind
it's
of
a
moment.
Brilliant, brilliant marketing.
I think this guy knows what he's doing. If we assume that he primed the reviews and has been speaking to the people on Twitter, etc., this is not the last.
So we say, "Well played, Mr. Dong."
For now,
well played. And Ashley has a response. What? No more Flappy Bird? Don't you think everybody now wants Flappy Bird because you can't get it anymore? That really increased the value of Flappy Bird?
There is an interesting angle here about what happens to all of this stuff that we use, all these apps and all, when they go off the App Store. And, you know, we have so many retro games on emulators and things from the past. And in this App Store era where we've got all this DRM'd stuff on our phones and all that, Flappy Bird gets pulled. I mean, if you delete it, you can't get it back. And in 10 years, somebody's going to write about what Flappy Bird meant, and it's going to be gone. and it does make you wonder. This stuff all seems a lot less permanent than software used to seem back in the day. Because, you know, you pull it off the store and it's gone. So. And you can't have a backup somewhere that you reload unless you're manually backing it up.
And the other thing is there's so much money in it that there's, all of these clones, Flybirds, Flappy Bee, there's Flappy Penguin. I saw on Android Farty Bird. It's exactly the same game, but you fart to get a crush.
Sure.
Flappy Penguin. I mean,
interesting. That's not an iOS.
I know. Anyway. It seems they used to have the market. They cornered the market on the fart programs, but that's just
there.
A sign that Android is an up and coming operating system.
Or the App Store wouldn't allow.
I'll tell you this much, and actually, this is a legit speaking from the heart moment. I'm kind of ticked that this is the dominating story on apps because there's a little game that came out this week that I love called Threes by Asher Bo, I think the guy who did Puzzle Juice. Just released a new one, and it's I love it. Threes,
is it iPhone
it out.
Or iPad?
iPad and iPhone.
Is it Servo LLC? Is that it? Is this it?
Or is it pink and white and blue?
Yeah, yeah.
That's it.
$1.99.
Yeah, great game.
All right,
fantastic.
I'm
going to
buy it. What is it?
It's a number game.
You know, it's but there's no real math. Like basically, you got ones and twos that you got to
combine into threes,
position to make into a three, and then after that, you're looking to take two identical numbers and mash them together to get bigger numbers. But it's very zen, and it uses what I like about it is. There are games that only use symbols and logic, and so you're able to do things like listen to an audiobook, and that part of your brain is not competing with the part of your brain that's moving your hands. Like the moment I'm happiest is when I'm like at the gym working out on the elliptical or whatever, and I'm playing a game that I'm manipulating symbols while listening to an audiobook that requires the language parts of my brain to be engaged.
You play Threes while listening to an audiobook?
Sure.
Yeah. It's on the elliptical. You're matching patterns and sliding things around. It's got a really nice, actually, bunch of audio. It's got some voices for the different pieces on the board and some music that plays in the background. Very smart game. Really, really nice game.
You'll get it. And this is also, you could tell, like, especially since he did Puzzle Juice, you can really see the way he's developed, game. Like, for example, here, this tutorial, you're going to be playing the game right now. Where it is, so it's you're just moving stuff around until it hits. Go until you hit a wall, and then they'll line up, and then you can mash them together. Keep going. Now you've made a three.
I've learned,
and then
and that was auspicious.
Big vocabulary.
Very good word.
Yes.
Yeah. New numbers.
But in this case, and it's got the right kind of blend of there's random reinforcement. You're sort of hoping to get the right kind of numbers at the right time, but you'll catch a run and you'll just, everything will go crazy. You can't believe you're getting all these points, and other times you die almost instantly.
Yeah, there's a Tetris-like aspect to it where what comes through in the stack onto the board will have an impact on whether you can make it or not that I really like.
It is good. All right, I like it.
It's what I like it is the numbers that come in are both your enemy and that you want to destroy them to free up the
just
space.
Just like Tetris.
But they're also your ammunition. Yeah.
Very much like Tetris. Now, why? Huh. Oh, two will only add with one? Well, how do I know that?
That's right.
Three.
How do I? Three.
Because it's threes.
I just saw it. This the first time I've seen this.
You're a ringer, aren't you?
But it's like you guys already got it.
No.
So how long do you guys think you'll be playing, Brian? I mean, how long do you think you can... Three will capture your imagination. That's what always amazes me about these games.
You're talking to a guy who had played... what I like about it is that it reminds me of Drop 7, which was a game that I played for easily 7 years. Or 6 years since it came out. And it's just one of those... things where you just become obsessed with it, and it's something I could do that doesn't, you know, like I say, it doesn't require the language part of the brain.
Everybody in our audience is now downloading Threes. I can't believe it.
Brought to you by
Threes. I just gave you all crack.
By the way, this is another thing that is, and I'm sure you've observed this, Brian, these rewards, even if it's not coins coming from a slot machine, these little rewards are what keep you going, and timing them in a game is so important.
Is this a social game? Can you play against people?
Nope. It's a
game. I'll tell you, I became very, it's the first time I've ever cared about Game Center because I could compare my score to my old assistant, John Tilton, lives on the other side of the country now, but I won't call him until my score is higher than his. so that I can be all like, hey, what's up?
I'm sorry, I'm busy playing Threes.
Yeah, okay. the high score element is definitely where the social interaction is.
But your own high score too, right? I mean, you're trying to beat yourself, I guess.
Yeah, it actually does a very good job of that. It keeps a record of all the games you've played sorted by highest score. So you can look back easily. Every time you finish a game, you can see where your current game ranked versus your very best games that you've played, which is also really smart.
What's cool, too, is like you know that what your goal is, of course. You want to stay alive, but in this case, you're out of moves. And that's the danger you get is as you do better, you hit this point where very quickly you start to realize you're in trouble and you shift the way you play from being, you know, all about getting the points, and instead you're all about clearing out space so you can stay alive. Yeah.
So good
that's
news.
Tetris aspect.
We have a replacement for Flappy Birds. It's just
I'd be okay with that.
That easy.
And the Threes will get knocked off just like Letterpress got knocked off. But
play Letterpress.
It's a great game too. So yeah,
this
I think Threes is going
to
be like that. Where it's beautiful and it's got it's got some classic.
It does seem to be that hockey stick up and down. I'm thinking of OMG Pop's Draw Something, which was very viral, but also died very quickly as well. Interesting.
Man, want to talk about the sale of the decade, man.
Timing.
It was amazing.
To Zynga, right?
Yeah.
For how much? How much does Zynga? Hundreds of millions, right?
Yeah. It was ridiculous. Let me see if I can find the actual figures here.
So this is a kind of running against the trend because Threes does not have in-app purchases, right?
Right. It's $2.
Just $2.
Yep.
OMG Pop sold for $210 million based on the success of that one game of Draw Something.
Less than a year later, the entire studio closed.
See, that's what the creator of Flappy Birds is missing out on.
Right.
If
he could have held out.
Wait another week and somebody will buy you for $200 million.
Why? There's fishiness.
Yeah. There's fishiness. Yeah. See? Technical. She's got a nose for news.
Here's the thing. Like, I don't care how many hate tweets that you're getting. $50,000 a day
is
utterly remarkable. Like, you shut the hell up and you deal with it. And unless you are hiding something, you know what I mean? Like, unless you're worried that all this attention is going to cause a problem for you.
Well, I mean, that is quite possible. But I want to leave a little bit of space open for the fact that this is a young software developer who was taken aback by the attention and is really sensitive and maybe... couldn't deal with it emotionally. I've known some software developers who shut down their company and walked away because they couldn't deal with the customers, or they had something else going on in their lives and this exacerbated it to the point where they felt it was wrecking their lives and they walked away. And that could be the case here. It's also possible that something is happening that we don't know about. But his tweets seem pretty distressed to me. So, I mean, there's a cultural difference there, a language difference. But
we may be filtering it through our own predisposition to making as much money as you possibly can. If he was making $50,000 a day for a month, he's got $1.5 million in the bank. He may never have to work again. He might have just said, you know, this is fine. See ya.
Well, and plus also, when you're that young and you have a hit, you have a tendency to believe like, oh, well, then I could just make hits whenever I feel like.
Right.
And I could see making that kind of rash decision.
Right. And yet there's more to it because he had three games. He promoted them all in the same way. Yeah. One went viral, then he disappears. I think it's a fascinating story, and I look forward to learning. To be continued, for sure. Flappy Birds 2 Electric Boogaloo will be out in a couple of months, I believe. Microsoft, I buried the lead. We have a new CEO at Microsoft.
Comes right after Flappy Bird.
Right.
I started with
Flappy Bird.
And, okay, we're going to get to that in a second. Holy cow. I'm looking down the rundown. Oh, yeah. Satya Nadella. Who could? Already we're bored with him. And he's only been in power for 4 days. Poor guy.
Did he make Flappy Bird? Then I don't care.
Scooped by Flappy Birds. Our show today brought to you by Carbonite Online Backup. God, I got to call. I get this every week on the radio show. Because radio show, normal people listen to. Guy calls up, says, yeah, my screen doesn't work anymore. 3 of my keys on my HP laptop don't work anymore. But all of my photos are on that hard drive. What do I do? He said, is it time to get Carbonite? I said, is it time to get Carbonite? Dude, he said, well, I do have an external hard drive. And I press the button. And it backs up every night. But I get up in the morning and it says 0%. Is that a bad sign? Mm-hmm. I said, yes, you don't have a backup. And your computer is dying. Please. Have a backup strategy, and if you do, remember one thing. When you back up, you got to do, I think, you got to do 3-2-1 backup. 3 copies, not one. Moving your file to a drive named backup does not a backup make. You have to have at least 2. I say 3 copies. You're going to have 2 different forms of media. One can be an external hard drive, but one's got to be offsite.
Yep.
If it's sitting next to your computer, we have flash flood warnings. Did your alarm go off on the phone?
Mine didn't.
It was like those old style radio alerts.
That happened to me this summer when we were in Cincinnati. There was a flash flood watch and woke us all up at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about that.
I was on an airplane just about to take off, and there was an amber alert that got pushed, and the entire plane all at once just went.
That's what happened in this studio. All of our phones went off.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I was on the air. In any event, that's the flash floods.
You can lose your data.
If it's
next to your computer, they will both burn in a fire or get flooded, and it doesn't matter. You got to be offsite.
So a good backup strategy would be, let's just now do a little thinking, automatic, so you don't have to remember it, continuous, so you change a file, it's backed up, offsite, to the cloud maybe, and that's what Carbonite does. And it does it very affordably. Less than $5 a month for everything on your computer. And it doesn't matter how much you have. They don't meter the storage. $59.99 a year for everything on a Mac or a PC. They have, if you go to Carbonite.com, they've got plans for small businesses, external drives. Always one low flat yearly rate. Plus, you can access those backup files anytime. Just log on to your Carbonite account or use the free apps. It is a great solution for backup. And probably there are people people who watch this show are certainly smart enough to have good backup solutions, but there are probably people who who don't. Your mom, your dad, your sister, your brother, the teacher, the pastor. Help them. Show them Carbonite. Carbonite.com. Do tell them to use the offer code TWIT because they'll get 2 free bonus months when they buy. 2 weeks to try it. No credit card needed, just the word TWIT. 2 bonus months when you decide to buy. Carbonite.com. So, Satya Nadella, there was a lot of drama around this Microsoft CEO search. Alan Mulally came up, former Microsoft folks, couple of guys in Microsoft beside Nadella, Tony Bates, the Skype CEO, was brought in during the acquisition. Stephen Elop brought in when the Nokia acquisition closed. But I think everybody looked at Satya Nadella and thought, this is the guy who's been in Microsoft 22 years, the obvious choice, not the inspiring choice.
I had a tough choice, though. I mean, I think what it came down to is the fact that this is a tough job running Microsoft right now.
It's really more than one job.
So I think the most interesting thing about the announcement was the return of Bill Gates as a technical advisor, spending a third of his time now back at Microsoft. And we don't know what that will be, and I'm sure for a while they will downplay it. But, he changed his position on the board so that he could officially, step in, spend a third of his time. And I think that's a recognition that Microsoft is somewhat ungovernable.
Your old newspaper, The Journal, said that over and over again. They said nobody wants this job because, A, it's too tough, and, B, nobody wants to work for a board run by Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer who also
– yeah.
Yeah. Nadella also got a seat. So all three CEOs on the board. John Thompson takes the chair position, yep. Which makes a lot of sense. Former IBM executive. He led this search. The rest of the board really are kind of non-entities. They almost feel like rubber stamp board members, frankly. So it's really, the thought was, and the journal said this over and over again, nobody wants this job because they don't want to have these guys breathing down their necks.
Yeah. I think it's also, I mean, we don't really know. So, we know that Alan Mulally sort of took himself out in some ways, according to himself. I mean, it's very hard to get a handle on how many actual candidates they were. I've seen
the Erickson guy took his name out. Yeah. They said 100.
They said 100. I think, I'm sure there was a lot of outreach. But at the end of the day, I think it was fairly obvious it was going to be Satya, in part because, you know, you've got to have someone who understands Microsoft in its current form.
That's, my money was on him all along. But they did have this perception that there's no vision. This is just going to be kind of a vanilla choice. And I think moving Bill Gates into the, quote, visionary role probably is a response to that. It also solves one problem, because if Bill's not the chairman of the board, maybe he's not so overpowering.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's there as
an advisor. That was my question. Is this getting Bill Gates more involved to get him more involved, or is it getting him to not be the chairman so that if Nadella needs to make some tough decisions about going in a different direction from Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer, is he going to be able to do that, or is Bill Gates going to be there over his shoulder 3 days?
It doesn't matter what chair he's sitting in the boardroom. He's still in the boardroom, and now he's at the company more often. And I think that, you know, if you read the sort of anonymous quotes being bandied around from insiders, it's, you know, all about what is that relationship going to be like? Is he going to have an office? You know, so I think that what's interesting now is to see, you know, what the strategy is going forward if they decide to sell off some stuff, which has been talked about. If the sort of Ballmer Nokia mobility push is going to be the sort of driving vision in the same way, what that deal is going to look like. And it'll be interesting. I mean, I think that everyone in tech wants to see some sort of decisive action, sort of moving in different ways, not just the same old, but, you know, the company's making money. It's doing fairly well. Same old might be sort of what we see too. So
what consumers want is very different from what the stock market wants. It's very different from what Microsoft employees and executives want. There are a lot of constituencies here to deal with.
I just want to know if this is going to be the return of Bill Gates is the devil talk. Because you remember, like, late 90s, everyone knew that Bill Gates is the devil. And then he spent a decade curing malaria. And then they're like, oh, I guess he's all right.
He's all right now.
Now that he's back.
And we had this conversation on Windows Weekly, of course, on Wednesday with Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley. And one of the points they brought up is Bill hasn't really been involved in Microsoft in quite some time. He's spent all his energy on saving the world. And what is Bill going to say? You know, I don't think the ribbon on the toolbar is quite right. You want to move that a little to the left? Or is he going to say, you know, maybe tablets aren't the thing? I mean, it's going to be much higher level advice.
Like he's getting hands-on with the code or making...
My suspicion is what Gates is going to be doing is he's there to back up Satya. Satya's faced against, you know, it's really weird to have a board with all three CEOs of a company on the board. Satya's going to... He in his inaugural address, Satya said, it's software. He said software again and again and again. He said, no, Microsoft's new slogan or new tagline is devices and services. We're a devices and services company. But he said again and again, but it's the software that runs on the devices and services that really matters. So what I think Bill's job is to go, Satya's right. Mm-hmm. He's there so Satya could go to the board and have a guy in his corner.
That's very feasible to me. You got to wonder. I mean, the CEO of Microsoft should not need backup. I mean,
this is an unusual position.
It is an unusual position, and I think it could work quite well. You know, I was sort of chuckling. Microsoft sort of did the dog and pony show of PR for this. So on the web, you know, there's who is Satya Nadella, and the video of him walking down the hall with the interviews. You know, so I mean, it's a huge company and it's a huge role, but. I did chuckle at the sort of branding campaign around it, but I'm really watching to see if there's any deals done. I mean,
if Satya Nadella thinks that Microsoft is never really going to have a market share presence for Windows Phone and for tablets that are running Windows, does he have the ability to say, guys, we need to focus on the cloud. We're doing great in the cloud. We've still got the base Windows business. That's a great business. They can talk about Xbox.
That's where Nadella comes from, by the way, is Azure and business and enterprise.
Right, which are doing great. I'm not sure anybody at Microsoft really wants to turn Microsoft into IBM. But that's my question is does he have the latitude to say, guys, you know, this phone stuff and the tablet stuff still, you know, it's going to be iOS and Android. It's not going to be us. So let's focus on being the back end services for all of those apps and not worry about this. Or is there just too much pride invested in that for Microsoft?
I think it's hard. It is hard to get out of the mobile phone business right now. I mean, it is hard to just give that up. And I mean, they've tried and tried and are trying again, and there's not a ton of movement. But I think it's hard to give that up. And, you know, Azure, they are not the back end for the mobile phone business. They're the back end for the legacy PC business. Right. And so, you know, I think that it's hard to see them giving that up. But, you know, Xbox, what do you do with that? And does that belong somewhere else? What do you do with some of these hardware projects like Surface and this other stuff? But I think I don't see how Microsoft can be relevant without pushing forward in mobile. But I think, you know, that was the bomber strategy, and it's too early to say. But I think the Xbox is one to watch, and you know, this has been floated out there of people wondering if you could get rid of that and focus things a bit, and what to do with the Excel business. And
the stock market is just indifferent to the whole thing. I mean, this is one of the things that's been a conundrum for so long. Microsoft makes a lot of money, and the stock has been flat for a decade.
Well, they like growth, right? And Microsoft is just throwing out its profit. It's the same thing that's going on with Apple stock right now. It's like, oh, these are really boring companies because they're not growing as fast as they used to. They're ridiculously profitable. Right. So it's a great business for them to be in. But if you're an investor, you want growth. It's just a different kind of company.
I mean, I guess that's the problem is one of the things that makes the stock market an efficient market is that it factors in excitement about a company as an actual commodity. And once that factors in, then it makes sense that everything would be flat because you're not actually buying it just with the intention of sitting there and collecting dividends. Oftentimes, you're buying it with the expectation that the stock itself will grow over time.
What do you do if you're Satya Nadella? You can't kill phone because you just bought Nokia.
I think you have to buy some other big stuff. So I also think we're going to see some really, really big deals in the tech space coming
up. Interesting.
Because you've got a ton of cash and you've got valuations pretty high, which is good if you're an acquiring company and you can agree on the valuation. You know, Google's on a rampage, which we've written a bit about. But, I mean, you could buy eBay. That's what I would do if I were Microsoft. I'd buy eBay. I mean, I don't think you can, but or at least the PayPal part of it maybe. But those are the kind of moves, and I know it's easy to say sitting back without, you know, being in the thick of things, but we're going to see a lot of, I think, we're at this level of sort of stagnant growth on a lot of things in Apple and elsewhere, and what's going to move the needle? It's going to be getting different skill sets and different products into these organizations and leveraging them.
Apple has $137 billion cash in the bank, of course, famously a lot, but look at that. Microsoft's number two, $68 billion in the bank.
Yep.
Google, $48 billion, Cisco, $45 billion, and Oracle, $34 billion. That's a lot of money just sitting there.
Absolutely.
Apple historically has been very reluctant to spend the money, partly because it's offshore.
Well,
there's tax consequences.
This week, Tim Cook said not only that Apple has bought a really surprisingly large number of businesses in the last year that we don't really hear about all of
them. They're tiny,
but they were all small. And then he said, and you never know, we might need to drop $100 billion on something sometime. Yeah. It's like, whoa.
That's what he always says when Carl Icahn and others are in the wing agitating. And I also think, you know, Apple's really striving to not appear boring right now. So at every twist and turn, they remind us they have new products coming and they're not opposed to doing big deals.
They never know. Something might happen.
But you're right. Icahn has been saying, give us the money. Pay a big dividend.
And
give it back to the stockholders.
I mean,
they've paid a dividend.
And it was one of the first things Tim Cook did and his watch that Steve had always resisted.
But Icahn wants more.
But you're right. It's hard to imagine Apple integrating a company that large into their culture anyway.
Be Tim Cook just saying, oh, no, Carl. Gotta save it for a rainy day. Never know. That's my mad money.
And I think they do look constantly. And I would imagine that they've looked at all sorts of crazy things we'd be shocked at. But I think that it's very different from looking and pulling the trigger. But I'm bracing myself for a very big, some mega deal making.
Interesting.
I do think that Microsoft, and not just for our benefit because it would be fun to talk about, but I do think Microsoft needs to focus and needs to change some of its business. It is trying to be so many different things, and I think sometimes at the disservice to its products. I think Windows Phone is a better product than maybe it has been treated as by them. I think right down to the name being just, we got everything Windows everywhere, maybe was a liability for that product.
Isn't that one of Microsoft's greatest sins of all time is insisting on putting their stupid name on everything. Like, from a branding perspective, you want a name to mean something. And Microsoft can't mean high-end enterprise solution and also a kick-ass video game console.
Right.
Yet they insist on putting that on there.
Really? Can it? I mean, Xbox seems like such a great wedge for Microsoft in the living room.
Right, but if they were naming that product today, they would call it Windows Game.
Which would be a mistake, obviously.
Yeah. I don't understand why
can't they just own, why does Xbox have to be branded underneath the Microsoft Mega logo? Why can't Xbox be its own company?
Do you think it hurts Xbox because it is?
I think it hurts Microsoft's brand. I think it hurts both of them. I think I don't like Microsoft in my game console, and I don't want game console in my Microsoft. Microsoft means enterprise solutions, and they should have embraced
that.
I think that's one
thing that's true, that Microsoft doesn't want to go the IBM route and become the enterprise solutions, services company. The devices is equal to services in Microsoft's new way of looking at things. That's why they do Surface, which is the first ever computer made by Microsoft. They do tablets. And they do Xbox. Those are the devices.
And they
what
bought
are the devices
Nokia.
And phones. Well, I mean, that's a third of their device portfolio. By the way, I didn't realize this, but Apple in the last couple of weeks did repurchase $14 billion in shares. They did spend some of that cash because of their poor stock showing after showing an incredible record profit. Okay, it's all confusing to me. Tim Cook spoke to the Wall Street Journal, and boy, I tell you, Apple's really good at getting the press, because he said, among other things, we have some very exciting new categories, and the world goes crazy. Yeah,
alert, Apple has new products coming in the future. Shocking.
He says there will be new categories. We're not ready to talk about it. Hasn't he said this like every year for the last
year? I
think
he said this at All Things D last year, last spring. I mean, he's been saying this for a while now. Some really great stuff.
He said anyone reasonable would consider what Apple is working on as new categories. Now, I want to tell you, on secret, I saw that Apple's working on a living room device with a transparent remote.
Well, it must be true, as we know this week. I mean, the number of journalists who wasted time chasing rumors on secret, I was actually going to put a few fake ones out there to ruin the competition a little bit.
But I'm glad you're not in my address book.
I didn't. But it's... Well, first of all, we know Apple's been working on a living room device and television device and all that. Now, I think the watch is getting close. And I mean, I think this is what...
The drumbeat seems to be mounting. Now, by the way, there's no one better than Jessica Lessen at covering Apple. Historically, the Wall Street Journal always had the best scoops. And you too, Jason. I'm not slighting you.
I'm not in the scoop news business
Different
here.
Parts
absolutely
of the
right.
Market.
Yeah.
But Jessica's real. So
absolutely.
What if you, both of you, between the two of you, heard about the iWatch? We're seeing now stories come out about all the hires Apple has made in health, in fitness, in fashion over the last year. It really feels like maybe that's what Tim's talking about. It feels like it's coming to an head. This year?
I think so, yeah. So actually, the reporter who's been way ahead on the watch is Mark Gurman of 9to5.
Very good.
And we should give him credit for that. And so what he and others, New York Times has also been very good on this, are saying is to expect the device this year, expect it to be very fitness heavy and not just how many steps did I take, but different oxygen readings and blood, you know, and I think trying to really move the needle on some of that stuff. Now, it's not clear how much of that would be in version one versus sort of a future roadmap, but I think it's very safe to expect something this year with a very heavy health and fitness focus.
Yeah,
look
at that list. Every time Kevin Lynch,
he was he doesn't count because he was at Adobe.
That was a little...
Let's take him off the list. Sorry, Jay Blonick though is huge fitness, very well known fitness guru. Was at Nike, worked on the Fuel Band there. Ron Raymond
Tim
from
Cook's
Phillips
on the board at Nike, which you have to remember too. So
Blonick is
Cook is on the Nike board. So he's been in a lot of Fuel Band discussions.
He wears one.
He does wear one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that sets the context for that device, too, is the Fuel Band is what they're thinking of, not the Pebble, not the Galaxy Gear.
Wouldn't Tim Cook have to leave the board of Nike if they release something?
That's a good question. We'll have to...
It's like Eric Schmidt being
on
the Apple board.
I think we'll find out later when all these reporters ask. He will have been telling us he's recused himself for meetings over the past 6 months or something like that. But it's...
Or it'll have Nike Fuel technology in it or something.
Yeah.
Well, that's a possibility too, right?
Yeah.
Roy Raymond, who is a scientist from Phillips, who was an expert in non-pharmaceutical methods for improving sleep quality.
Yeah.
including miniature sensors. Paul Deneuve, former CEO of Yves Saint Laurent, little fashion in there. Of course, Angela Arendt, who was from Burberry, CEO of Burberry, who came in to run Apple Retail. That was a very interesting move. A step down, it looked like, for her. She'd been a CEO.
Yeah, it's a different move.
I think that's less about the watch, too. Although Burberry has made a huge push into watches, actually.
She led the change from Burberry being kind of a stuffy old English brand to being a little bit hipper.
She also reined in all the licensing deals that they had done. So she is a very, sort of...
That was the problem with Burberry, was that they were licensing it to everything and they were becoming associated with...
I think that's a Burberry pattern on your Brian Brushwood logo right behind you, as a matter of fact.
It might be.
Yeah, she was the reaction to that licensing strategy.
Now, I don't think she's at Apple yet, though. There's a transition period. This spring, she's coming to Apple.
Yeah, and...
But get ready for plaid. Everywhere. Ben Schaefer, director of Nike's Innovation Kitchen. Ewan Block, director of engineering at C8 Metasensor. They're the ones where I think you swallow. Is that the one where you swallow a non-invasive ways to measure glucose levels and other vital signs?
No, that's the thing that it's like a camera that looks inside your skin with a special light and finds your blood glucose and things like that.
Yeah, that's a Vital Connect, I guess.
One thing I wonder, this all sounds so wonky, too. I mean, I think the thing to remember is that Apple stayed on the sidelines of the space until it has something it thinks can be mass market, right?
Right.
And I'm, happy to use all this stuff, but I don't think that the vast, this is not a mass market. No one's going to be tracking stuff like that. So I think it's interesting because the device is obviously going to have to do a lot more than this kind of stuff. And I also really wonder if we're yet at the point when this is sort of the direction of the selling points to go sort of mass market. And the iPhone, when it first came out, wasn't mass market. But I think, the reason we've seen all these other devices from Samsung and Pebble and Nike and Jawbone and not from Apple is because I think they've been waiting to do something that feels very different.
Something that 50 million people will buy and not 1 million.
They can't do another Fitbit.
But, that's exactly right. Although Apple always is about hardware and software working together. And I think about these sensors, and you're absolutely right. The quantified self movement is only, this tiny little fraction. But if you can take an app, and if you can take that coprocessor that they've got on the new iPhone and iPad models, and you can take all this data, and then the software does something interesting with it, whether it's some way to tell you it's time to wake up in the morning, whether it is something about your diet or about your exercise. If they can crack that, it could be really interesting, and that would be something that a regular person might want. It's like,
is exactly the kind of thing that I could see Apple having the ambition to do, because they're in a great position. They're sitting on a mountain of cash. If I'm Apple, I'm not thinking in terms of what's a gizmo we think people know that they want. I'm thinking in terms of how can we transform the social reality of everyone around us? How do we create a movement of this? How do we take this nascent, as you said, self-quantification and turn it into something that everybody does, that everybody knows, like there's a plan that'll get you more hours of sleep or take care of you for X, Y, or Z. This ability to, essentially hack your own operating system by virtue of being able to monitor everything all the time, I think is something they could sell. And I think smart for them to be quiet.
This is good for your magic act. Bluetooth-connected smart pills that you swallow. You can have it pass from one eye to the other.
Yeah. So what would the smart pill measure? Would it be, I guess, like, what, your gastric levels
juices
or something?
Nancy Dougherty, one of the people they hired, is a hardware engineer at a company called Proteus Digital Health. I think Apple had an investment with them as well.
You see,
smart patches and ingestible Bluetooth-connected smart pills.
See, what I've read about the smart pills is those aren't necessarily medical. Those are actually ID things where you take your smart pill at the beginning of the day and then you don't need a key card.
That's good.
I'm not kidding. It like unlocks your devices and stuff.
What Proteus does a bit. So Proteus is more tracking if you've taken your meds and then also how your body reacts to them. So there's a lot. But one of the things I think is important to think about in what it's a great point of, Apple wanting to create a movement or a product and a system and an ecosystem that really is mass. But we have to remember that it's not really Apple's core competency around this data stuff. I mean, when you start to match, and build services on top of how I'm sleeping and recommending things based on that, I mean, you're really into the sort of data science-y stuff that, frankly, Google is just a lot better at. Yeah. And so I think that, Apple is going to need and has been trying to get the expertise to do that sort of predictive work off huge data sets. And
would they be smart to do partnerships instead of trying to do it themselves?
Well, I think it's hard though, because if you're going to be the if you're going to be the platform and you want all the apps to sync into your data and all that, you really have to control that. And so
the rumor was they're going to do a passbook style health book on iOS 8 that would be in fact a repository for all this stuff.
But how useful it is will be based on what they can do with the data.
Partnerships.
To be honest, usefulness has nothing to do with it, I suspect. Because think about it. The way we all perceive our health, it's almost like a religious thing. There are people who are anti-science because they don't want genetically modified foods. And there are other people who think that yoga gives them superpowers or whatever. It's like, you know,
of those are true statements, but okay.
Yes, and that's fine. That's fine. Okay. But what Apple should do is position themselves like, here's the device that unlocks you and gives you all the numbers to work with. And they should be accurate sensors and they should be able to figure out X, Y, Z. But then you get all of the health gurus from your crackpot Dr. Oz's to your Dr. Weir's to your Sanjay Gupta's to, you know, everybody sets their own plan within this framework. Then Apple benefits from having created this ecosystem, and it's all the people, it's all the partners that people are subscribing to follow their plans.
But Apple
have to get that middle bit right. I mean, I just keep going back to Google Now tells you when to leave, you know, based on traffic and your normal driving patterns, right? You have to have some level of that kind of analysis off the streams of digital health data before you start talking to the Dr. Phils and the sleep experts and all of that kind of stuff. And so you need systems that know how to learn from the data. It's machine learning. It's all this stuff that is kind of the rage right now. And, you know, Apple has never really done that successfully. And they've made some tiny acquisitions to try to bring more of that expertise into the company. But that's going to be a huge focus, I think, to make their platform. Because remember, Google is doing the exact same thing. I mean, Google, even after getting rid of the Motorola mobile unit, they've got their own watch projects. They obviously have Google Glass.
They kept Motorola's R&D. So
they took Regina's team and ported it over. So, I mean, it is an arms race. And Apple can have the sexiest device in the world, but if they don't get that piece right, they're going to lose.
I can almost promise you they will have the sexiest device, and they won't get that piece right. Are you saying, so I want to be clear, that they need to do this in-house? They do need to develop this data understanding a la Google, or is it that they go to RunKeeper and they go to all these?
It's both. So before you can even get to working with RunKeeper, you have to be able to take this data and learn from it and figure out what to pass to RunKeeper. So I think it's both. I think that Apple's systems need to know in the same way that Google Now tells you when to leave because of traffic. I mean, there is some level of how to handle this data, how to analyze this data, and how to package it up. I do think developers will build a lot of the end apps on top of that. Yeah. But developers are going to go to the platforms that are the easiest to work with and give them the most actionable data. Right. And if you're pulling it off devices, there's a lot of software that Apple has to build. And I think, you know, if they do go that health apps route too, some of this they'll look to do themselves, you know, much in the same way they do on phones, right? They have some apps like Maps and they have others. But
Can you think of in any case where Apple has done this well? Something like this Any case where I look at Mobile Me, I look at Maps, I look at all of this kind of middleware
data. No, I think they deserve
data.
A better... I think Maps, they did a nice job. I think it's just they are so far behind Google in terms of the years of experience and learning from the data and in the capabilities. I think they also underestimated how hard a problem that was. But if they've learned from Maps...
I was going to answer your question, Leo. I will say, like, Siri, I think they absolutely have nailed it
disagree.
On. I think that
Siri is half-baked... Google surpassed them immediately.
Yeah. And the problem with Siri is it doesn't talk to anything really yet, too. So Siri is a great example of where they had
a great interface
and a very nice sort of version one.
It does less. Siri does less than the app
talk
that they
to
bought.
Anything. It does.
The app they bought did more. I could make reservations.
Well, but again, we're talking about perceptions, and in that regard, I think that Siri, like, first of all, the way they've crafted the personality, I think is very smart. I think that the snarky answers have you tried asking Siri this stuff?
Yeah.
Like, it's definitely underutilized, and it's not where it needs to be. They need to be down the road being able to buy subscriptions to various personal assistants from Jarvis on
I could give you so many examples. Passbook is another example where lots of promise. Very little delivery. And it, I'm not knocking Apple. I just think that this is a tough thing for to do in general. And Apple is, unlike Google's data driven from day one. Apple's a hardware company.
I also think, and it goes deep into the cultures. I mean, Apple waits to release things and till they're sort of ready at these stages instead of iterating constantly. That actually holds you back in this kind of service model and software and services. And I think, you know, Maps is probably not a bad analogy, actually. A lot of acquisitions ahead of time. A lot of work went into the data. You know, the product had some problems, but frankly, it wasn't as horrible, I think, as people said. And now they're slowly, slowly improving it. So if they've learned from that, I think that they have a shot in this other space. But I do think Google will eat their lunch on it.
And don't forget, too, that this is a hardware product that is going to rely. Apple's not a hardware company. It's a hardware and software together making products company.
Okay, you're, yes,
and
I stand corrected.
This is a piece of hardware that is going to require software integration to succeed or fail. And I think Apple is much better at that than they are little software add-ons to existing. The iPhone is not going to succeed or fail based on Passbook or Maps.
It's an ecosystem.
Right? Yeah. But this this imaginary, soon-to-come watch-like whatever, that software has got to work or that product is going to be worthless. And I think Apple's actually very good at that.
They understand that.
And that may be why we haven't seen it yet, is because this is hard, and they have to do it right. They can't kind of do it halfway and hope that it's okay, because this whole product will fail if they don't do the software right.
I think I'm like a lot of people. I look at the prototypes for the watch. I imagine it will be beautiful. I will buy one. I think a lot of people buy one. But then it better deliver, or you're going to really have a problem. And the one advantage, now I'll step back and say the one advantage Apple has is nobody trusts Google. Or not? Well, I don't know. Do people trust Google?
I don't know. A lot of people don't. Some do. I mean, I think it's...
I trust them, but I mean, the normal people trust Google. And do they... For Google had to shut down its health repository.
Yeah. For uploading your own records.
Yeah. But Microsoft has a very, by the way, a very well-developed health vault, but Google doesn't. And I think people are a little bit nervous about Google. And as Google wants to gather more information, like critical stuff like health information, they might get more nervous indeed. Whereas Apple, people trust Apple, yes or no?
Yeah, no, I think they do. I think they do more than Google. I think it also depends how ultimately you use this. I mean, I think you're completely right. Like, can Apple build some basic software on top of it that integrates with APIs to tell you what to eat or to go to sleep or to go to the doctor? Yes. But what about when our health data changes our thermostat based on how we feel? Or something, you know, and that bigger picture where it's integrating to so many different services. That's where I, I'm running ahead. But I think that that's where that competency in data and integrations could come back to bite Apple. But I think, you know, for the beginning, you can start very basic. I do wonder, though, I guess it depends on the price point, but can you really, really get mass market with something that tells you how well you slept, you know?
That's kind of the beauty of Apple. They don't have to be that mass market.
That's true, sir.
This is going to be
it be aspirational, and then it will come down. That's true.
I mean, they're trying. We're talking about the differentiating features. I mean, I've had a Pebble that I've worn more or less for the last year. I've had it for a year now, and I mean, what I've learned in the last year is that the ability to glance at your wrist and see if that text that just came in is worth responding to or not, doing some very specific, simple triage, not doing phone things on it, but just doing some glances.
Well, what,
that has value. You know what it too.
Is there ever a time when your phone isn't next to you when you have your watch?
It's in my pocket.
It matters. Like this is why you don't have to worry about Apple. Apple can throw whatever horse crap it wants to with medical whatever and sensors that taste your sweat and tell you if you have this much or that much or whatever. It doesn't matter, because as long as it works and doesn't overstep and has good battery life, people will discover the joys of not pulling your phone out every single time a message comes in.
It's got to look good. That thing. I have a couple
smart contact lenses. Then we're not going to need any of this.
That's right.
So, I mean,
I want that. I forget Google Glass, forget a smartwatch. I want a heads-up display everywhere I walk. I want things popping up over your heads. I don't want to see life at all. So,
good.
The problem with this is it's ugly. And I think that's the promise. Come on. You think that's pretty?
I had a Casio calculator watch when I was a kid.
You're the wrong guy to ask.
I don't think the Pebble Steel is a solution to the problem.
I also don't know how big a problem. Like, everyone, it's easy to find the examples. Oh, I was in a meeting and someone texted me and it was urgent and I could solve the problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know how much. And, you know, my Pebble's still sort of in a drawer.
Mine's
so I should really,
That's so crazy because, like, I use the
what are you wearing? So I don't see a pebble. Is that a pebble?
Oh, there
you go,
it is.
Right there, bro.
Wow.
Right. There's a pebble. And in fact, like little things, like nowadays, I'll come, I'll be on the other side of the house because I always leave my phone on silent now, which I don't have to have annoying, loud, you know, exploding sound effects whenever someone calls now, because I could be on the other side of the house and just look and be like, oh, someone's calling me right now. And I'll go run into the other room and then realize I'm not going to get to the phone in time. And so I'll just hit answer when I'm still around the corner. And I know I bought myself like 5-10 more seconds before I get there to pick up the
phone.
But
you can't talk to the pebble.
No.
You can't actually answer the phone. You have to go to your phone.
You still have to get over there. Look, I'm telling you, man.
Hello?
Structurally.
Hello?
You add up all those little 8-second moments.
Yep.
There's so many of them every day. I've probably saved, just in the first few months, I've saved hours, literal hours of this crap. If you love, hold on. It's there it is. If you love that moment, then don't get a pebble. But if you want to never,
you know, my advice, keep it in your breast pocket there, because it comes out much easier, as you know.
Yeah.
The breast pocket. Well, that's good, because my
here's what made the vest work.
You don't have a vest? Everybody should have a vest.
Fanny packs.
The lesson of pebble is that it doesn't try to do too much.
Yes.
It just does a few things, and it does it exquisitely well. You charge it once a week, and that's it.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to put mine on. You going to put yours on?
I will put mine on.
Yeah, we're going to... It's 2-4-2 against. We'll try it.
Yeah.
But I do think if Apple made something that was gorgeous,
right.
Yeah. I'd be much more likely to wear it than this, which frankly doesn't look, even the steel, we just showed the steel, doesn't look much better than that Casio.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, it may look more like that Casio. Yeah. My point is that there are those table stakes that we often ignore when we're talking about these exciting health things, that there will probably be some very nice integration with your iPhone's notifications and remote control and other things like that may be also
Android?
Reasons I don't see how it would.
And I'll tell you what, here's the other thing, is if Apple's smart, they will make it expensive as hell because they're moving into the fashion realm. And you can get away...
$350? $400?
No. $500? $600. I want it to be $600. Like that's the thing, is it needs to be a status symbol. The mere fact that you have the money to spend on it, that's where
they'll
need to position.
They'll have the gold
version. They need to create a new category for the ultra high-end smartwatch.
There'll be a sport version that'll be cheaper, and then they'll have the... elegant version.
Beyonce version.
It's the end of Swipe and Sign. We'll talk about that in just a second. GoToMeeting, our sponsor today. By the way, great panel. Thank you for being here. Mr. Brian Brushwood from NSFW Scam School. Don't forget his new National Geographic television show, Hacking the System, debuts February 27th. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Jessica Lesson from The Information, theinformation.com. You must subscribe because... it's a good thing. Did that fap for you, Brian?
It was good.
And, of course, from IDG, editorial director. That means he's in charge both of the Mac side and the Windows side. So he knows what he's talking about, Mr. Jason Snell.
We've even got an Android site now. It's fancy.
Really?
Yeah.
And what's the site that you developed for them? I keep forgetting.
TechHive.
TechHive. Yeah. I love TechHive. Got to plug that more often.
Too many websites, I'm telling you.
But TechHive is really great. And it's, you know what? It's friendly. It's fun. It's exciting. 6 Academy Award nominees to stream on Netflix. Must have mobile apps for Sochi Winter Games.
We may be one of the few websites to have a real movie critic writing about what's streamable on Netflix.
I'm excited.
That is awesome.
Jeffrey
Anderson, who writes for the San Francisco Examiner, and I went to high school with. And he writes now streaming for us. It's
that
cool.
is fantastic.
Does Netflix have alerts where you can find out
if a show becomes available?
What is it? Is it like Netflix Watcher or something?
The chat room will tell us.
Seems like a...
that you can actually get notifications and it will beep you and it'll email
when
you.
When something you want to watch
when things
available.
Are going to expire.
Or when it's leaving.
Watch them before
it
goes. Yeah.
This is what we need. Innovation.
Chat room, it's not Can I Stream It, although that's a great site as well. Is it InstaWatcher? InstaWatcher. We will check into that while I talk to you about GoToMeeting from Citrix. The weather outside is frightful. On the East Coast, Atlanta, once again, if you live in Atlanta, get GoToMeeting. Once again, gridlock is coming. There's a storm up north. We got rain here. We got flash flood alerts. This is a terrible time to try to do business. But GoToMeeting solves that. GoToMeeting means you can meet, you can collaborate online no matter what the weather is like outside. In fact, frankly, I wish the weather bad all the time. I could stay home. We could do GoToMeeting. I know teams that keep GoToMeeting running all the time. You could see, share screens, so you see what people are working on. And by the way, you could pass the screen around. So everybody in the meeting could show their screen. Great for coding together, that kind of thing. If you turn on the video cameras, and everything these days have video cameras, you can see each other in crystal clear, high-def video. So when you can't make it into the office, you can still meet. You can be productive. Go to meetings, awesome. You can even host a meeting, present from an iPad. I love it. Works on all the mobile devices. Go to meeting. I want you to try it free 30 days. Visit gotomeeting.com. Click the green. No, I guess it's not green anymore. What color is it? The orange try it free button, whatever. The one that says try it free. Use the promo code TWIT, T-W-I-T, and you got 30 days absolutely free. Go to meeting. We use it for meetings here. In fact, even when we just want to do a teleconference, because you get a phone bridge, we always use GoToMeeting just because then you also have the chance to share the screen if you wanted to on the video if you want, that kind of thing. Instant watch, that's not it.
Yeah, I think that is it. But unfortunately, Netflix has actually made their API worse lately, and now you can't get the expiration date.
That would be a feature that I would think Netflix would want.
You know, the movie companies may not want Netflix.
I don't know.
It
does highlight the weakness is that stuff is only temporarily available. So I can understand why Netflix wouldn't want that.
And they claim that when they shut down that API, I was just looking. It sounds like it's not always accurate because they're apparently doing last-minute negotiations to bring things back.
I see.
So it'll
see.
Look like it's timing off, and then it won't.
That's interesting.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
But that would be good to have more info about what's coming and what's going on.
What's your Netflix pick? House of Cards, right?
Oh, can't wait.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, House of Cards season 3 is already apparently in the works.
They got approval. Yeah.
Thank goodness. Yeah.
So Dana Brunetti told me that we would have Kevin Spacey on as soon as season 2 was ready. So I'll let you know.
Yeah. Wow.
Kevin's an old friend. You know, Kevin's a geek. We had him on the Screensavers a couple of times. He's an old friend.
I do remember that.
Yeah.
Well, he's the one that was banging the drum saying that you know, people want to be able to cut the cord.
Incredible video he did at the YouTube conference in Ireland.
Yeah, that was a great speech.
Inspirational. See, if you haven't seen that, go watch it. It's incredible. So finally in the United States, where we have been saddled with the old-fashioned credit card for far too long, I think after the Target breach, finally MasterCard and Visa said, all right, we've had it. It's over.
Chip and PIN, we're going to do it.
Chip and PIN is coming October 2015. All the major credit cards will do it.
Everybody in Europe who deals with American travelers is breathing a sigh of relief because you're trying to buy something.
Now, pretend I'm actually not a tech host and explain to me Chip
and
PIN.
All right, so look at this box on the Wall Street Journal's page about this. This is when you go to a restaurant in Europe, the waiter comes,
even Canada, yeah.
Yeah, or anywhere, really, except the United States. Where we still use proudly the imperial system for feet and miles.
Yes. You give your credit card to somebody and they take it away and you don't know where it's going and then they bring you back something.
10 minutes later, you get a bill.
Yeah.
But who else knows what else you got? You probably get crabs too. So this is, no.
At a seafood restaurant. A
seafood restaurant only. This is what you get in Europe. You'll get a little box. The waiter comes to you. He swipes your card. You enter your PIN number. You pay that way. You know what you paid. You may or may not have to sign, the PIN is sufficient.
Right.
The idea is now, I don't know why we never adopted this. Some people said that Americans think it's too complicated. MasterCard.
It's a pain in the ass.
Very
diplomatic.
No, it's not. MasterCard,
right,
very
diplomatic. You have zero liability. I could give out my credit card number right now, and everyone could run it up, and I have no obligation to pay anything that is done with that.
Right?
There's no liability.
Right.
So over Christmas, Target, first it was 40 million credit cards breached, then it was 70 million credit cards. Then they said, actually, it's probably more like 100 million credit cards, including PIN numbers and Target ATM cards and all that, breached. I think that was probably the last straw. I imagine these credit card companies had to issue millions of new cards to people and finally just said,
you stick this thing into the slot. It reads the little chip that's on the card.
There's a microchip in the card.
Yeah, and then you put in your PIN, and that's what unlocks it. And knowing the credit card number won't get you anywhere.
They have to match. Now, of course, you could make a card with a chip in it. You could duplicate it, but it's a lot harder, more expensive. The chip has to be, it's probably encrypted. I think it's a little bit more tricksy. Although never count a hacker out, and I wouldn't be surprised if they figure this out.
Look, I understand the benefit to Visa and MasterCard. Of course they're going to want to do this.
If it was up to
them, there would also be biometrics in there, sure. But what's the benefit to us, the consumer? Why is that so great? That doesn't sound like a fun, easy experience. I don't want to have to be in the middle of a discussion over dinner, like, excuse me, let me secret code over boop, boop, beep, boop, boop.
Come on, Brian. That's not hard. What are you talking about?
Do I get mad? I still get mad that I have
to put my sign the check code. Or do you say, take my money? I don't care. Look, do you figure out the tip? That's too hard. Don't make me figure out the tip.
You're talking to a guy who just was singing the praises of the 8 seconds every hour.
I know. But seriously, it's easy. I don't think it's any less
than putting your card in the little thing and then having it on the edge of the table for the guy to come and take away.
It's not hard.
They come with a little thing and you... It's a different thing culturally, but... I think the benefit is that if somebody tries to steal your credit card number, you don't have to like change your number and change all your auto pays on all your accounts.
Sure, you're not liable, but it's still a big pain in the ass. Have you ever had your credit card stolen, Brian?
I lose my credit card all the time. And then I'm like, give me another credit card. But then I just memorize the number and then whatever, it's fine.
The other problem that is maybe you haven't had, but I have all the time, is we get our credit cards turned off all the time. Because we do something that the bank deems, scary.
Including traveling.
Including buying gas and sneakers, travel, all normal things. And so it'll be much nicer to have something more secure. I hope it's...
So Brian is the reason we don't have it yet.
It's your... I now understand. Yeah, I could never understand why we didn't have it.
Well, and you know what? Actually, you bring up a good point. If going chip and PIN is a minor inconvenience every single time I use it, but it saves me from... the major inconvenience of them shutting off my credit card because they have, they see something they don't understand.
Right.
Then I might be on board with that, but I don't know. Just structurally, it's like, I understand why they want it. I'm just surprised you guys want it. That's what's weird to me.
Well, as
I want no credit cards. I mean,
yeah, I agree.
I thought we were finally getting rid of this card that it was going to be phones and other things, and
that would be nice. But traveling outside the U.S. right now is really scary, because
you can't buy gas.
You
can't buy gas because you have a swipe card and they won't take it.
Right, so some places only do chip and PIN, and other places they can do American style transactions, but the people in the stores aren't trained on how to do it. Mm. Right. I had to show them the slot at one place in London where they're like, oh, that's what the slot is for. It's like, yeah, you slide the card.
Oh, we've had that slot for years. Yeah, we never knew what it was for.
There was a small family of birds nesting in it. For international travelers, this will be great because our cards will be equipped to use that system and they won't look at us like we're crazy people. But you're right. I can't tell you how many times I've left my wallet at home but had my smartphone in my pocket and realized I should be able to pay for something with this and I can't do it.
Well, there's Tap and Pay. More and more you can, but it's not widespread.
Yeah, and there's Square stuff.
Apple did not adopt NFC. Which means that's not going to be the solution because there's
it's all Bluetooth LE and iBeacon and all that stuff.
In fact, what my solution would be now would be I would load up my Starbucks card and then have Starbucks scan my barcodes. Phone and I'd buy a sandwich at Starbucks. I think would be how I would do it if I didn't.
I forgot my wallet and spend a day eating out of Starbucks. That way, it's very effective.
Yeah, but it should be easier.
Save that for your life hacking show, there, Brian.
There you go. Yeah. I like it.
That's a good little tip. How to survive by living on Starbucks. Speaking of Bitcoin, Mt. Gox has announced they're not going to allow you to trade in Bitcoins for cash for a while. Mm. Is this the beginning of the end for Bitcoin? Russia says no Bitcoin. China says no Bitcoin. Actually, it's more complicated than that. You can have a Bitcoin in China. You just can't use it.
does it matter if the government's... I mean, isn't that
yes, and I'll tell
Bitcoin
you why.
Is you don't need the government's permission?
Well, it matters because a lot of the value of Bitcoin at this point is speculation, right? So Bitcoin, for instance, is now down to $676. It lost about 50% of its value because of these couple of data points.
Did Mt. Gox give a reason? It's pretty suspicious. I mean, there were some questions about liquidity and all that stuff.
I mean, look, if I'm... Okay, let's go back to John C. Dvorak. Put on our John C. Dvorak's hat here. If I'm a government, damn right I don't want cryptocurrencies out there. Damn right I'm going to say we won't accept it. We won't trade it. We don't want it. We don't like it.
I understand why the government's like it either.
Especially oppressive governments that really want to monitor every single thing that happens.
Yes, if you have a centralized government, having a second currency system that's out of your control is not desirable. On the other hand... It is probably very prevalent. I'm sure barter and other sort of systems occur in, the more repressive the government, the more likely you've got that, right?
And using other currencies that they can't track.
And
here's the Mt. Gox statement. You parse this, Jessica. Okay. In our efforts to resolve the issue being encountered by various Bitcoin withdrawals, it was determined. That's always a sign, by the way.
It was passive voice.
It was determined that the increase in the flow of withdrawal requests has hindered our efforts on a technical level to understand the issue thoroughly. The system needs to be in a static state. So a temporary pause in withdrawal requests.
That's so much nonsense because, look, I mean, that's Forex exchanges are all based on the ability to have a dynamic marketplace where people speculate and some win and some lose and some form of equilibrium is created as a result. And it's like, I don't know, like, who cares if the governments disapprove? The more the governments disapprove of Bitcoin, the more legitimate I think the platform sounds to me.
Well, the interesting thing about this, though, is it. So we did a story a while ago about what a Bitcoin bank run would look like, just from the sense of how much liquidity is there in the system. And you have all these different marketplaces for buying and selling. But a lot of those businesses are making money by themselves trading Bitcoin, which means they may not have cash or Bitcoin or anything to pay out. And so this, which I actually just heard about, raises a lot of alarm bells in my head about, you know, whether Mt. Gox is in liquidity issues. And that is a big concern. And we have to remember, you know, this isn't the first time. I mean, Bitcoin's been around for a long time and there have been issues like this in the past. So separate from what happens in terms of regulation or whether it gets adopted as a payment mechanism, the sort of stability of the current system is, I think, in question now because of this.
Perception is very important. Yeah. Perception in something like this is very important. And, you know, you have this on top of the Silk Road and Ross Ulbricht, this arrest now of Charlie Schrem for money laundering using Bitcoin.
The Bitcoin Foundation, I believe.
Of course, happened with real money. That's normal. But the problem is, at this point, perception is very important in terms of the value of Bitcoin. You see it's dropping in value. So I don't know. I've always wondered if Bitcoin is just a pyramid scheme to benefit Satoshi Nakamoto and the others who created Bitcoin, who presumably have mass amounts.
Well, you know, currency is a consensual hallucination. Like, even cash, I'm giving paper to you, and you were giving me hard goods. It's crazy. But with, like, U.S. currency or a euro or, you know, any government currency, we sort of have this expectation that hallucination will continue for a long period of time unless there's a zombie apocalypse or something like that. Bitcoin, I still am in that state of I'm not sure whether the fever will break and this hallucination will end. And that's the scary thing for me about it.
That's fine. I mean, from my perspective, like, we started accepting Bitcoins on scam stuff and it was great because we had people who had a bunch of Bitcoins who wanted to buy our stuff at scamstuff.com. Shopify had an app. It took about 20 minutes to install it. And now, you know, the moment it goes, whatever the current exchange rate is, I get real money. Like, I don't think it's as dramatic a decision as you guys are making it out to be. I think it's a bunch of little guys like me saying, like, yeah, sure, that's a type of money. Sure, go.
Yeah, but do you get the Bitcoins or is somebody converting those Bitcoins into cash?
You can choose to either deposit it into your own Bitcoin wallet, which I don't. I just translate it at whatever market rates is. It's the same as if someone wants to spend euros or British pounds or whatever.
I don't have a problem with that. I'm worried about if I'm holding Bitcoins when the music stops.
Yes.
Okay, then don't hold them. Then I mean, I don't get it. Right. Just get them and spend them.
Yeah.
And it's still there's still a really good purpose for them, I think. And as far as like, I just think that the people who got in early want to get rich. Hells yes. That's why they built this platform. That's the reason you build a platform that you hope the whole world will like is so that you can get rich making it.
Yep.
And the best way to do that is to make a really good platform that a lot of people like. And in this case, you know, current, like, real money, I'm using air quotes here, is inherently inflationary. The Fed just prints dollars or whatever. That's not a great system that I would build from the beginning. And in this,
actually,
at least,
that's a lot. But now you're getting into areas of economic theory that are fairly abstruse and complicated.
Sure. Well, the way old
there is, in fact, rate, a real value is, to being able to print money
especially if you want the press.
No. It's very important.
That'll be the topic of this week's TWIM.
You cannot get out of recession unless you can
point.
Do that.
This is my point, is at least somebody's trying something different. Let the marketplace of ideas hash it out.
It will.
Let a bunch of people with their own personal interest decide.
Yeah, I don't think the U.S. government is going to say, oh, no more Bitcoin. I don't think that's going to be an issue. It will. The only issue would be people who, you know, take, like you, maybe take Bitcoin and then keep it and then lose their shirt, as you say, be holding Bitcoin when the music stops.
I love it as an idea. I just, as an investment, it seems awfully insecure. That's all.
I'm holding my Bitcoins because I believe, like the Winklevoss twins, that they're going to reach $40,000 a coin.
All right,
and I am going to be rich.
How many coins?
Seven.
Wow.
See, you guys are crazy. You guys need to be in Dogecoin. That's where the action
is. Yeah, that is.
We Pure actually, coin. Twit is really into the Dogecoin. I believe we have a Dogecoin miner in the basement or two. Do we, Chad? Did Father Robert? Yeah. We have, okay. This talk about the nexus the light, of Chad. Weird stuff. Our resident Jesuit priest
has been teaching everyone else how to mine Dogecoin.
Okay, I ask you. Conspiracy much?
I believe the current count of the whole brick house with everyone's Doge is somewhere in the 2 million to 3 million Doge coins.
And you know, the Doges were the bishops of Venice, which is in Italy, which is where the Vatican is.
I rest my case.
I'm just saying. It's
a conspiracy.
He keeps going, pay no attention to that Doge coin in the basement.
But when the next pope is one of those dogs, we'll know the jig is up.
Have you guys seen the DogeWeather.com app? It's if you go to DogeWeather.com, it basically gives you a Doge version.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Wow. Light rain. Wow.
Such moisture.
Such mild.
So moderate.
So moderate. Wow. That's cute. That's probably better than dark skies, actually. That's lovely.
You don't need all that detail. You just need a Doge.
I don't get this meme, by the way. I just want you to know I don't.
It's just expressing the gestalt of idiot dogs.
I don't understand the internet. You know one thing I'm going to tell you right now, because I'm the oldest guy here, by probably a long shot. It used to be when you'd get old, the music would get louder. Kids, their hairstyles would change. You just kind of would mildly not approve and not understand it. And then you would fade away. I can see already this is happening to me. It is going to happen like a landslide from now on. When you guys get old, it's going to be, I don't understand anything at all. It's all Dogecoin all the way down. I'm telling you.
The singularity, Leo. The singularity doesn't happen at once for the whole society. It happens at an age range. It's like when you turn 45 and you're like, I have no idea what's going on anymore.
It's terrible. It's terrible. So, Jessica, you said, now this is interesting. So, Secret, which is another app that's taking the world by storm. Goodness. This is a, but no, this isn't the first of these. Whisper came out earlier. This is a direct copy with one exception. The idea of Secret is you share stuff. It's on your, it's like Twitter, but anonymous, and you share stuff. But the difference, and the reason I think it's so successful is, unlike Whisper, which was totally anonymous, you can tell if the people we're sharing are in your address book or friends of people in your address book.
Yeah.
And so the part of the fun of this is looking at it and going, who could that be?
I don't know about you, though. I got a lot of people in my address book.
I do, too.
And so it feels like that little friend, circle of friend thing isn't that telling. Although it does set off the game in your head of...
There was a secret about Flappy Bird. That was really exciting.
Yeah.
Flappy Bird was by far the worst game I've ever played. Now, you can heart it, and then it will go to more friends of friends. Here's the other thing, is people are, just like with Twitter and everything else, not really sharing their deepest heartfelt secrets. They're trying to be clever.
They're trying to be clever. And if you're trying to be clever, you usually want credit for being clever, which is why you then see people screenshotting and posting their secrets.
My secret.
To brag about their secrets. So that's kind of a disconnect.
This is my favorite troll that I've seen on Secret. Was somebody put this out. It says, from a friend, this is a fake sponsored tweet that everyone just goes nuts and getting all mad. They're like, whoa, is this a joke or whatever?
I can't believe Ford is spying sponsored secrets.
And then it says here, the best is the response is test drive a Ford Fusion and you'll see it's no joke.
That's brilliant. I'm going to do that to my circle of friends.
Yeah.
So this is somebody in my address book saying everybody has to stop using Secret because I have a minor philosophical quibble with it. And so, I mean, I think that's kind of fun because you're trying to think, well, but you're right. I have like 1,000 people in there.
Yeah.
So our journalists, but then there's things like...
So the funny thing that happened this week is, well, someone, there was a secret posted saying, I work at Evernote and we're about to get acquired.
Right.
And so then, of course, the... fabulous cohorts of tech journalists think, oh, holy shit, if there's even a shred of truth to this, I can't get in trouble. So everyone calls Evernote and all their Evernote sources and says, and so Phil Libman, the CEO of Evernote, tweeted, there's no truth to this. But, I mean, the Wall Street Journal covered it. Like, people, I mean, they, right. this is what distracted a bunch of tech reporters, which,
for,
tiny plug for
do.
Why the that's information
squirrel.
Is awesome.
Squirrel. That's actually kind of brilliant. That's a brilliant use of secret.
So, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, this is great. You know, I'm working on these six stories right now. If I just post to secret the opposite of these six stories, then everyone's going to have to spend their time tracing them. But, you know, it's so early. It's really hard to see how that will play out. But there's this... I mean, because when you have a bunch of tech people using this, right? I mean, you're going to see a lot of this, and there may be some shreds of truth to it. You know, from what I can tell, it's a lot of, you know, there's, I have the techie strands and making fun of Valleywag and so forth, but,
poor,
you know.
Dave Morin at PATH somehow has become the butt of massive amounts.
But now there's been a reaction, too, so now there's a lot of positive PATH. Secrets.
Yeah.
So
see, you and I probably have similar friends.
I think we do.
Yeah.
And you know what? When we, if we found out who these people were, it was probably like three of the people are probably friends of ours, right?
Right.
But you know, there's a lot of self-helpy kind of stuff. You know, people talking about their moods.
R.I.P. You, Flappy Bird. You. Our grandchildren will hear stories of your brilliance, but will never be able to experience it.
Something like that. Like that's clever, that's and funny. The person should want. You know, they're probably. Why not put that in the public world?
Because there's a million people
you know?
Putting that on Twitter, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll see. I like the team behind Secret, actually. I think the guys are great, former Google guys, worked at Square, very nice engineers. The app, actually, for something that's kind of not intuitive to use, I think they did a really cool job of sort of educating you how it works. I just not sure what
people
this
may
thing
be
evolves
wondering,
into.
Gosh, Leo, your friends are really boring. Why isn't there more sex, love, and rock and roll, sex and drugs? I prefer leftovers, particularly when cold. I guess the secrets of my friends are just not good.
Well, the secrets of most people probably aren't that good, you know? And so
oh,
I
my
think
God, look what somebody's just posted. I work at Twit, and we're about to be acquired. Oh, my God. I
the information
pray that
is going to acquire Twit.
Pray that that's true. Okay. You know, the other thing they did is you can put your own pictures behind here.
Yeah.
And that makes it kind of a little more.
It's a great. The app itself is really nice to use. I mean, apps are getting great in terms of design and features and.
Minoxidil, it's not working. It also does notifications, which makes it particularly.
Oh, and they're like, your friend has shared a secret.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
It's the most.
Smart.
Enticing notification.
So Whisper did all of the did the same basic thing, but didn't take off, and Secret did because of little things like that.
Well, I also think, I mean, it's hard. This week, basically, Valleywag posted a stream of secrets, too. And so, you know, it's getting some, it's the echo chamber talking to the echo chamber. So we'll see.
Alexis Ohanian with clean shaven, hot. Alexis Ohanian with beard, Will Wheaton. All right. Anyway, enough of that. Enough of that. I'm glad we're getting acquired, though. Did Chad? You posted that, didn't you? Chad Johnson, why I oughta.
I did. I did make sure to, like, the only post I've done on Secret was I confessed that for a year I kept it secret that I was working on a show called Hacking the System, coming out on Nat Geo. This
Sponsored tweet. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. If you are going to the post office, stop the insanity. The post office is filled with amateurs. If you are sending stuff out as your business, does he work at the post office? Is that why you patted his leg after I said that? I'm so sorry, sir. But it's true. I love the post office. But if you want to mail out bills or flyers or promotional material, if you, you know, you work at Etsy. You make this beautiful hand macrame golf club cover and you sell it. You don't want to take it to the post office and give it to them. You want to be able to ship it without getting up from your desk. That's what Stamps.com does. It turns you into a fulfillment house, professional. Postage rates changed. They just changed again. You don't have to worry. Unlike, say, in a postage meter, you don't have to pay to get the postage rates update. You don't have to bring it into the post office. It just happens automatic. It's software. So you'll lose all those time-consuming trips to the post office. You can buy and print official U.S. postage. You could print stamps. I do. But you can also print right on the envelope with your logo, the return address. It'll pull the address of the person you're mailing to from your address book or from QuickBooks or from the Etsy site or PayPal or Amazon or eBay and on and on and on. If it's international, it fills out the forms for all the international mailing. The post office actually comes to you and picks it up. There's this thing called the mail carrier. It's incredible. They come. They have a leather bag. They put your thing in and they carry it off. In fact, there's even a button on stamps.com where if you missed the pickup, it says come back, and they'll come back. So, I mean, it's just, you're going to love it. I'm being a little silly, but really I do use it and love it. It's just fabulous for our little business.
You know what I found out?
Oh, you use it for your store, right?
Yeah, dude, it saved the day. When we first launched Scam Stuff, we did like a Indiegogo campaign and did like $30,000 of pre-sales. And then all of a sudden, I realized I needed to solve a lot of logistics problems all at once.
Right.
And we went with stamps.com and we used promo code TWIT and it totally saved the day for us. But do you know what I found out like after a year? Like I used to worry about like printing out your metered postage. It has you put the day that you're going
to
send it out
and
on
you
there.
You have to send it that day.
I didn't realize that if you're a day late, they still take it almost always.
Me like, neither, yeah, apparently.
Like, see, but apparently, like I was reprinting all of these doing everything over, you know, canceling and then redoing or whatever. But apparently, like as long as within it's a couple of days, they don't have a big problem with it, which is like.
So if you buy on scamstuff.com, a little plug for Brian, sponsored. You will be getting, you'll see, in fact, when it comes to you, you can see what it looks like. It really looks nice. Very professional looking. I want you to try it. We have a no risk trial offer. Normally, if you go to stamps.com, it's $80. This is a better one. Go to stamps.com, click the microphone in the upper right hand corner there. Yeah, right there. And, use our offer code TWIT and you'll get a $110 bonus offer. That's $55 in free postage. You get that USB scale. So you always know exactly what the right postage is. You get a supply kit and, of course, a free month of stamps.com. Stamps.com, click the microphone, use TWIT as the offer code. So Scam Stuff still going great guns for you, huh? That's great.
Yeah, man. Well, I'll tell you what. You know, Dan Carlin, who does the Hardcore History podcast, talks about how there's really, like, in this new media space, there's, like, different legs to the stool to keep everything afloat. And,
right.
And if you're a small independent broadcaster, maybe one is you have an Amazon affiliate code, or another one is you accept direct donations, or maybe you sell your back catalog of content, or, you know, maybe you have a small online store. And it's amazing. If you don't mind taking responsibility to, you know, do a whole bunch of little things, we're a three-man operation, and so far we're able to keep the lights on just by having all those little legs to the stool.
I have to say, I think that's always been the case. I think about my friends who are photographers. Very hard to make a living as a photographer, but if you teach, if you do books, it's always been the case that if you can kind of small-time transmedia, have multiple different things that you're doing.
Sure.
It's a great idea. You use Patreon too, right?
Yeah. We use Patreon for over at Cord Killers. That's a direct subscription model thing where it's like, it's interesting because somebody will make a decision. And if you're a content producer, I love what they're doing at Patreon because somebody can pledge, let's say, $1 an episode. So it's $4 a month. Like once you get on their credit card at $4 a month, they have to make an active decision to unsubscribe from your show, which means like somebody to acquire a patron on patreon.com is much, much more valuable than getting a big payout from a Kickstarter campaign early on,
right?
Because that money runs out, whereas this is an ongoing pledge and a subscription.
Very interesting idea.
Businesses,
But this is it just for podcasts or it says be a patron of the arts?
It's for anything. Like for example, you see like there's YouTube videos, there's comic books, there's right there in the upper right, she's doing like investigative journalism.
I love
Scott
that.
Scott Johnson the with the Morning Stream is on that list.
Yeah, a lot of our friends. Tom does that. You do that. I know with Cord Killers. Yeah.
That's and then really cool. Geekbeat TV, there's Callie Lewis on there. It's a lot of familiar faces, and I think this is a good structure that's showing up in here.
Yeah.
The only thing I don't like about it is
5,000 per episode.
Well, that's per month. See,
oh, per month.
This is the only thing that's frustrating is it gives a false sense of success sometimes. For example, like let's say that was $1,000 per episode. And it would say they're making $1,000 per episode. And then everybody who's a fan of the show thinks like, well, I don't need to help. They're making $1,000 per episode. You can the pledges per episode can be inconsistent with the max pledges that people give. So, for example, people can pledge $10 per episode and then set a max of $10 per month. So your first episode, you get $1,000. Next episode, you get $800. Next episode, you get 400. Next episode, and so on. So, but they're aware of that problem, and they're figuring out a way to make it a little more transparent. But I think it's a great way for independents to get their stuff out.
I think absolutely, and I think that of course we're obviously a free ad supported media, which is a model I like. Jessica's a paywall, which is another model that works for the right kind of content. We couldn't do that; nobody would pay for us. I'd like the idea of crowdsourcing it. There are lots of ways to do it, and that's the point: is there needs to be for an ecosystem to be growing. We've got to solve that because we've moved from the days of mainstream content into this democratic form of content, which is so great.
Do you remember Michael Robertson of MP3.com predicted the era of the middle class rock star? And I think about how much he was so right about It's also middle class patrons and middle class, media moguls and middle class. I mean, it's amazing these micro networks and the ability to reach an audience of just a couple thousand people is enough to, my friends over who do the Rage Select podcast, have a fraction of your numbers or even of my numbers, but they're super passionate and they're able to stay afloat doing because of direct contributions through Patreon.
It also affects, so we're a subscription business, not just to have revenue and sustain us, but we think we write better content. So we don't cover the day-to-day tech news. We focus on in-depth stories that sort of drive the conversation that aren't being reported in the daily news cycle. But, I think different kinds of content, when you have certain business models, they encourage and create a type of content on top of that model. And so one of the things that's exciting about we're sort of seeing the subscription blossom a bit in the media business is because I think it's going to change that more types of content that we see will have greater diversity and we'll have more depth.
There's always been the concern that investigative journalism, for instance, which is very expensive, would die without these big patrons. But it's clear that we're starting to see now a way that this can work. And I love Michael Robertson's middle-class rock star and middle-class patron, too, because, of course, it was only the Medicis that could, have enough money, enough surplus to have Michelangelo paint. But now anybody can. A couple of bucks here, a couple of bucks there. And I think that's a more natural system and I think more sustainable.
On a personal level, you get a much more tailor-made experience. Oh, yeah. Like, because of on the one hand, yes, it's a problem that everything's so fractious nowadays. We all live our own little social bubbles. But the benefit of that is that you can find yourself connecting with content that's almost made specifically for you, which is an experience that only the very rich were able to do just 20, 30 years ago.
We need that.
And people they attach to some of this stuff. I mean, podcasts are a good example. Websites are a good example where they feel so attached to it. And it used to be there was nothing you could do other than to send them. Maybe you buy a T-shirt if they do a T-shirt sale. But there's really nothing you could do to say, I appreciate you, other than, just go to their site. And that's the nice thing about something like Patreon is you can say, I like this so much that, I will throw in $5 every time you do this, this podcast, or $5 a month. And, you just couldn't do that before. It's not the mandatory micropayment. Like, to read this article, you must put in 10 cents. It's more like, if you really love this stuff,
Support it.
And, it's easy, which is, it's a great idea.
I think it's a really good way to also get feedback from the audience, because you're not going to make it unless you find an audience, and it's so easy in mainstream media make a show that has no audience that nobody wanted.
I'll tell you, this is the other thing is you feel the pressure to
That's the other side.
They're your boss. Yeah. They have a dollar stake in it, and you don't get to blow them off. And you're like, okay, this is what you want. Then I guess we're doing that now.
Yeah.
So that's customers, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, one last story. We didn't talk about Twitter. Anything to say about Twitter's first quarterly results?
User growth was low, which scared a lot of investors.
And a lot of existing users tweet less, engage less.
So just big spotlight on users.
It's not a surprise. Anybody who uses Twitter knows that, right?
But, I actually think, so we have, we're working on some stuff on it, because I don't actually think that user growth is the right only metric to look at Twitter's business
right now.
User
engagement's the metric.
There's a lot, and there's also different kinds of businesses it can go into, but the results spooked the market a little bit. Yeah. But, the PE multiple is still 50 or so. I mean, it's huge. So investors are still, the stock is very, very... Not 50. It's way, way above 50.
More than 50?
Yeah. Oh, considerably. The stock is at 50, but it's north of 100 the multiple. Wow. So investors still have very high expectations for Twitter.
Wow. The speaking of Twitter, the dying Chinese moon rover, Jade Rabbit. This is straight out of WALL-E. Tweeted its goodbye. The rover is going through the two-week lunar night, very cold. It's built to survive it, but normally it would fold up its little rover solar panels and hibernate, and it wasn't able to due to a technical malfunction. So there's some concern that after the lunar night ends that Jade Rabbit will be no more. And apparently it's Chinese miners who are tweeting for it. Now, they say tweet. I couldn't find the tweets. They're awfully long, but then I realized it is in Chinese. It's possible because it's such a compact language that this is 140 characters. It looks like it. Although I should have gone to bed this morning, my masters discovered something abnormal with my mechanical control system. My masters are staying up all night. That's, he should talk like Hal, right?
Like Hal, yeah.
Working for a solution. I heard their eyes are looking more like my red rabbit eyes. Nevertheless, I'm aware I might not survive this lunar night. That's kind of beautiful. Only the Chinese could do this, I think. If this journey must come to an early end, I am not afraid. Whether or not the repairs are successful, I believe even my malfunctions will provide my masters with valuable information and experience. I don't know. It's hard not to cry when you read this. The sun has already set here. The temperature is falling very quickly. I've said a lot today, yet I still feel it's not enough. I'll tell everyone a secret. You know, you should use secret. Actually, I'm not feeling especially sad. Just like any other hero, I've only encountered a little problem while on my own adventure.
Oh, so you think you're a hero now?
Apparently. Jade Rabbit. Finally, good night, planet Earth. Good night, humanity.
Ominous.
Yeah, no kidding. I didn't think of that.
So if you
I have this little missile here.
If you check out Thursday nights, I want to say, Daily Show with Jon Stewart, Patrick Stewart reads a dramatic reading.
Why didn't you tell me? Here I am.
No, that was good because you went a little more the Hal 9000 route than Patrick Stewart.
Patrick did a little dramatic.
More, a little more dramatic.
All right.
A little less Android.
We'll do that as our bumper out of this show. I don't want to prolong the agony any longer.
My mind is going.
My mind
is going. Good night, Earth.
Thank you so much, Jason Snell, for being here. It's always a pleasure. Incomparable on 5x5 Network.
Yes, thank you.
I am so jealous.
Podcast.
And, you know, I don't want to call her Sinestra. We had Serenity Campbell on.
Serenity Caldwell, right.
Caldwell.
Right.
Sinestra. I don't know why.
Sure.
Maleficent Caldwell was on. And she was talking about, you do radio plays. You did the Christmas play. I listened. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Great acting.
Thank you.
You know who's good? Glenn Fleischman.
Glenn does a funny accent.
He can act.
He can do a funny accent.
He does the greatest Doctor Who ever.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
Theincomparable.com.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Great stuff. And what is the story of this? Is it just a bunch of Macworld editors and you? And
it's a bunch of my friends and other people I've met, and we talk about geeky pop culture. So movies and TV shows and stuff.
How many times you've been on my shows, invited me to be on.
We'll talk. All of my Audible recommendations that I do here are from there.
The Incomparable. So highly recommended. Incomparable.com.
Theincomparable.com.
It's
like the information.
You gotta have the.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, was Patrick Stewart dressed as a Jade Rabbit as
he
well?
He was.
Oh boy! If I had known that, I would not have essayed that dramatic reading. Mr. Brian Brushwood, NSFW. Great to have you.
I feel jealous. You got the information. You got the incomparable. I feel like it needs to be the hacking the system.
I think so.
The hacking system.
What is this with the definite article everywhere? The Twits.
Dot coms are hard to find,
feels
man.
Feels like a publication, you know?
Ah, that's it.
It's the one, the only.
I used to work at a radio station that was the sports leader.
Yeah.
Great to have you, Brian. I appreciate it. Good luck on the show. Can't wait to see it, Hacking the System, on Nat Geo on February 27.
Yeah.
And, of course, Scam School on Revision 3.
Yeah.
Jessica Lesson is at theinformation.com. And was information.com taken?
We were going after both of them, but the came up first, and so we just went for it.
I kind of like it.
Mm-hmm.
In media publications, you know, you have the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times.
The Ohio State University. Yeah. It makes
sense. It's kind of funny. I have this sheet of names that I carried around for 6 months when we were coming up with the name, and we just got it framed and put it in the office.
Oh, that's fun.
And there's a big X in front of the, which makes me think at one point in my brain, I decided we didn't
know the.
But now, forever, that's a little secret, but forever.
We have it.
We have the.
There is the there. Thank you for joining us. We do this show every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's 3 plus 12 is 5. We'll carry the 7. 2200 UTC on the Twit Network, twit.tv. If you're watching, we love it if you watch live. If you can't, on-demand audio and video is always available after the fact at twit.tv and wherever you can find Netcast. You know, we had some great shows this week. I'm not sure I want to show this promo because I understand there's some brief nudity.
What?
Take a look. This is what you missed this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit, Tech News Today.
So the current funding system is just really focused on small incremental projects. That's where we hope to come in, give these kind of wild, risky, innovative ideas a platform.
This week in enterprise tech.
Let's put it in the good news corner because Microsoft needs some good news. And that is Windows 8.1 has become more popular than Vista.
This Week in Law.
I'd like to start with something Don wrote comparing the copyright wars with the alcohol prohibition.
i5 for the iPhone.
The game is evil, it is mean, and I refuse to participate in the losing game that is Flappy Bird. Flap, flap, flap.
Twit. Tech just like you like it.
Yes.
Well, make sure you tell me next time.
By the way, I hear that Nick Bilton's next.
Oh, God, my eyes.
Where?
Next book is going to be called Hatching Flappy Bird, the behind-the-scenes, Troy.
It's more of a pamphlet.
It's short.
E-book.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can.